Good morning to the staff supporting us from Parliament, and also to the presenters that have come in to share with us their views and comments on the NHI. We are here starting with the first presentation, but before that, I would like to, as I welcome you, give an opportunity to our staff members, in particular the secretariat, to indicate the members that have joined in, who will then be taken as being present, and those who might have indicated that they are apologizing to note that item for attending. I'm sorry, because of where I am, it may just be difficult to have a video and talk, so I prefer to just leave it this way. If I can give this opportunity to Ms. Majalamba.
Good morning and thank you, Chair. Present is Dr. Lomo, Ms. Gela, Dr. Harvard, and Dr. Thembi Kwayo. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we are early by 5 minutes.
Okay, I think we should wait for other members to join the meeting, because it's only five members in the platform.
And we are also early by 5 minutes.
Yes, Chair.
Yeah. May I check, Mr. Stavros, or whoever is presenting, if they are all here?
Good morning, Honorable Chair. We are all here indeed. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thank you. So long, can you request the sharing rights so that when you start, we don't waste time, you just have that sorted out logistically. But yes, we will wait a bit for our members, another 5 minutes, because we are starting at 10:15. Thank you very much.
Sure, thanks. Gavin, have you been given sharing rights? Gavin Bauer?
Yes, morning everybody. Thank you, Chairperson. We have got sharing rights. We are prepared to go. Thank you very much.
We initially welcomed
recording in progress.
Those who had logged in initially, it was the Honorable Gela, Honorable Dr. Thembi Kwayo, Honorable Dr. Harvard, and I. We have since been joined by other parliamentary members, who I would like Ms. Majalamba to also record and note the others that have joined us.
Ms. Wilson, Ms. Ishmael, and Ms. Chiroche. Thank you.
Honorable members, we will then start. We do have a quorum of our members. We are meeting Mr. Nicola not for the first time. He is now coming in another cap. He has been here before us. But maybe before that, let's just share. Ms. Majalamba, show us the agenda for today. Okay. Honorable members, we have three presentations that we are going to be with today. The first one is one that will be led by the team that is already logged in. It's a presentation by the Pharmaceutical Task Group, PTG, as they abbreviate it. At 11:30, we'll have a presentation by Sister Gennis, if I'm pronouncing it last well. And the last presentation is by Beckton Dickinson. So we welcome the first presenters, and you do have 45 minutes to lead the presentation. We will have to stop you after 45 minutes. Mr. Nicola, we are familiar with this process, because we have seen you in the same platform, coming in a different cap. After 45 minutes, then the members will engage with yourselves and the clarification-seeking questions, and then you will come back again to clarify those questions. So your 45 minutes will start now, and now you do have the sharing rights, as I learned it, so you can then start presenting. Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Dr. Dlamo, Honourable Members of the Committee. It's a great pleasure to be back here again. I came previously under a Business Unity South Africa cap. My primary workplace, so to speak, is in the pharmaceutical industry, and it is in that capacity that I will be presenting with my colleagues today. May I at the outset, just be on behalf of the Pharmaceutical Task Group, while we get the next slide, may I firstly express both our condolences for all of those who have lost their lives over the last 48 hours in the protests that have spread across our country, and also our solidarity with all of those that have lost property and other belongings. Chairperson, if I may very briefly introduce the Pharmaceutical Task Group. We were established in 2004. We're an umbrella organization that represents the various constituencies within the pharmaceutical manufacturing and supply industry. Our members collectively represent more than 80% of the pharmaceutical industry in South Africa. That's both in volume and value terms. Our constituent members include the four associations that appear on the right-hand side of the slide, the four being the GBMSA, which is the Generic and Biosimilar Medicines of South Africa organization, largely representing the generic industry. We also have the Innovative Pharmaceutical Association of South Africa. These are the R&D-based companies. We have PharmEASA, which is pharmaceuticals made in South Africa, representing all the local pharmaceutical manufacturers. And lastly, the Self-Care Association of South Africa. IPASA and SDA have also presented here previously. The purpose of the Pharmaceutical Task Group is to consider and respond to any issues of common interest to these member associations and the pharmaceutical industry. We are patient-centric and place the interests of patients at the center of what we do. In summary, the PTG strives to contribute to establishing an environment in our country that promotes both growth and investment in the South African pharmaceutical industry, whilst at the same time aspiring through our actions to broaden access to medicines for all people living in our country. Next slide, please. Okay, I'm going to introduce the three presenters before I get into the slide deck. Honourable members, you've previously met myself. I'm Stavros Nicolaou, the chairman of PTG. I also have with me our colleagues who will be presenting, two other colleagues who will be presenting with me today. The first is Gavin Bauer, if you could just put your screen on. And then lastly, my colleague Rilani Nhlaniki, who will also be presenting part of the slide. Okay, let's move on with the presentation. It would be remiss of me, honourable members, not to mention the role that the pharmaceutical industry is playing at the forefront of this pandemic and any other pandemic, of course, that we've experienced previously or will experience futuristically. We know that vaccines represent the single biggest intervention in turning the tide against the pandemic and restoring a semblance of normality to society. We are feeling these impacts of a constrained and subdued society as we speak here today. And of course, the industry that is at the forefront of all of this is the pharmaceutical industry. The main thrust, therefore, of our presentation today is that we support national health insurance as the PTG, but with the appropriate funding and financing mechanisms. And it should be, in our view, a universal coverage model that does not disrupt the pharmaceutical supply chain. If it does so, then this industry cannot be at the forefront of vaccines and all the other pharmaceutical interventions that are required with any pandemic, and just generally, pharmaceuticals and vaccines are the most important of interventions in managing both chronic and acute diseases. We therefore see medicines as a significant health system enabler. We do not see medicines as a normal commodity of trade, as some have suggested. These are specialized products requiring special conditions, specialized knowledge and skills, and the likes thereof. Without medicines, healthcare systems cannot achieve their stated health objectives, and neither can we improve healthcare outcomes. We, of course, know that over the last 50 years, lifespan and longevity has almost more than doubled in some instances, and this is largely because of these pharmaceutical interventions. And then lastly, without being repetitive, of course, COVID-19 has demonstrated firsthand to us that medicines are a healthcare solution for patients and nations at large, particularly in these times of pandemics. And effective responses, healthcare responses, can only be achieved through collaborative partnerships across the private and the public sector. And I think we are living proof, as we sit here today, how the private and the public sectors have come together and collaborated in our country to provide an effective response vis-a-vis the COVID pandemic. Next slide, please. Okay, as I was indicating earlier, honourable members, the PTG supports universal healthcare coverage in our country. However, our main consideration is it has to be achieved in a fashion and a mechanism that does not disrupt the pharmaceutical industry and or supply chain. Needless to say, a disruption would have significant consequences both in terms of availability of medicines, security of supply of medicines, and health security in general. Let us unpack this comment a little more. And you will see in a subsequent slide that the pharmaceutical industry, together with the medical devices and diagnostics industry in our country, is the only one that currently services both the public and the private sectors. So the current levels of healthcare financing, we recognize, are both unsustainable and undesirable as we sit here right now. There is clearly an inequality in healthcare financing across the private and the public sectors. We certainly, in that vein, would be supportive and are supportive of a more equitable healthcare system. We are also supportive of more equitable distribution of healthcare resources and infrastructure to achieve the constitutional mandates that underpin this goal. We also recognize, however, that in order to achieve the most effective and optimal universal healthcare coverage in our country, we need to accept that both the public and the private sectors have very specific and particular strengths, and we should be leveraging these strengths individually and collectively in order to address the inequality that resides in healthcare in our country. We are concerned that some of the current provisions of the bill would lead to either a disruption of the private or the public sectors. It would dilute some of the strengths that we are referring to. So whilst we support universal coverage, it should not be at the expense, as I keep saying, of the sustainability of the pharmaceutical industry. And there are some concerns that that might be the case. Gavin and Rulani will unpack this a little more later on. In essence and in summary with regard to this slide, honourable members, it is essential that the national health insurance system is backed by a sustainable healthcare sector in order to ensure security of healthcare provision and medicine supply. Next slide. When I talk about sustainability of healthcare supply, of pharmaceutical supply and health security. I'm also acknowledging the role that the pharmaceutical industry plays in the economy of our country. There's been a lot that's been said in recent months about balancing lives and livelihoods. And the pharmaceutical industry is a clear demonstration of that. It has a significant focus on public good and public health, and keeping the nation healthy. An unhealthy nation can never contribute to the economy in any meaningful way. So there is a public health element in the first instance, but in the second instance is a sustainable, viable, vibrant, and robust pharmaceutical industry is an important engine room for the economic growth recovery of our country, as outlined in government cabinet's ERRP plan. But it is also an important enabler in terms of both individual, sectorial, and overall economic growth. And again, a pharmaceutical industry that continues to be viable is an important enabler to both public health and also economic growth. I was saying earlier in respect to this particular slide that the pharmaceutical and medical equipment industries are the only ones that presently participate in both the private and the public sectors of our country. And there is a subsidy, cross-subsidy, that exists between the private and the public sector. And that cross-subsidy provides a balance that enables us to participate in both the private and the public sector and to make medicines accessible to both of these sectors. It is in this vein that when one looks at the bill in its present form, that the PTG respectfully submits that a single-payer, single-purchaser model will not meet the medicine treatment needs of our country, as you will have in all likelihood a disruption between this public and private sector balance that I just referred to earlier. The PTG in addition also calls for the adoption of a flexible hybrid pricing framework for medicines in order to improve both patient access and healthcare outcomes. We are also of the view, again in the context of the bill, that rationing of NHI medicine benefits to lower than the current patient benefits that are available will compromise both patient care and healthcare outcomes in the medium to long term. And lastly, the PTG supports complementary health insurance. This will ensure sustainable patient access to treatment, again because of the balance I spoke about. It will ensure a sustainable healthcare sector, improved healthcare outcomes, and lower patient out-of-pocket payments. We know that these out-of-pocket payment issues have become very real issues, and many, many families right now as we speak are struggling as a consequence of this. We feel that complementary healthcare insurance would provide the balance that I keep referring to. So in summary, before I hand over to Gavin for the next section of the slides, in summary, at an overarching and overriding level, the PTG is supportive of universal healthcare coverage, provided that the industry, the pharmaceutical industry that is not disrupted, security of supply and health security is not disrupted in our country. Thanks very much. Gavin, if you could come in now.
Thank you, Staros. In order to give the committee more visibility and insight into how our industry functions between the two healthcare sectors, we thought it's important to give you some facts that demonstrate how we currently operate between the two sectors and how this cross-subsidy that Staros was talking about manifests itself in the current structure and how we should leverage it for the future. So just to give you a feeling in terms of the size of the public sector medicines environment, the public sector procures around about 15 billion rands worth of medicines per annum. And in the private sector procures about 46 billion rands worth of medicines per annum. Of the 46 billion, that includes over-the-counter products, vitamins. But if you focus on prescription medicines, this is Schedule 3 medicines and up, the private sector consumes about 29 billion rands worth of medicines per annum. The most important thing to understand when we consume medicines in the two sectors is what's the underlying health need of the patient in each sector. So what we've done is to illustrate for you, obviously, in the public sector, the vast majority of medicines spend is spent on HIV vaccines and antibiotics, whereas in the private sector, there's a different healthcare need being addressed with medicines consumption. If you look at the top three areas that are used in terms of medicine consumption in the private sector, you'll see it's antidepressants, anti-ulcerants, and then HIV medicines. So you can see the underlying healthcare needs are a little bit different between the two sectors, and this is why we believe we need to consider that healthcare need when we develop an NHI package, and then based on that, what the NHI fund will procure. To give you a feeling of what's available, obviously you know medicines are based on medicine molecules, and if you look at medicine molecules that are procured in the public sector today, it's around about 500 molecules are procured in the public sector through the tender sector, through the tendering mechanism, and in the private sector, about 1,000 molecules are procured within the private sector. To give you a feeling on, you know, what's the level of competition from a pharmaceutical manufacturer point of view, there are currently 81 manufacturers who compete in the tender sector, and in the private sector, there's about 178 registered manufacturers that provide medicines into the private sector. So what you can see is the differences between the two sectors. So what are the implications of NHI for us as a medicine sector? We do not believe that adding the current medicine expenditure up between the two sectors will reflect what NHI needs to procure. And we'll illustrate that a little bit later in terms of the benefit package. We do believe that NHI needs to procure medicines in line with the underlying disease burden in order to improve healthcare outcomes in South Africa, but that the NHI package needs to procure more than the 500 molecules currently being procured in the public sector. We do not believe that a single-payer winner-takes-all procurement system will improve healthcare outcomes, nor will it improve economic growth or job creation for our sector. And as Stavros said, industry sustainability is one of the key concerns that needs to be recognized when developing an NHI package and how medicines will be procured. So the key essence of this slide is one, a factual basis, two, some implications for our sector on the NHI, and three, the more important point to make is there is an interdependence between the public and private sectors today, and we believe as the PTG that this interdependence should be recognized in the development of the NHI package going forward for medicines, and this is a critical point for us as an industry. Moving forward in terms of our second position, in terms of why we want a flexible hybrid medicines procurement system for NHI, we see some contradictions in the current bill because there's lots of concepts like the single exit price, how medicines will be procured, will prices be set, what will be the formulary underpinning purchasing of medicines. For us, there are some contradictions that need to be resolved. But in essence, what we are putting forward is that we believe a flexible hybrid model for medicines procurement should be the basis of the NHI fund's medicines procurement. Why? We believe a flexible hybrid model for medicines procurement will ensure patient access to medicines, ensure security of supply is maintained, and then also considering the sustainability of our sector, because if we're not sustainable, we cannot ensure security of supply for our South African patients. So we believe that these issues need to be resolved within the NHI bill, and we have in our submission made recommendations in line with this. If we move forward in terms of a hybrid flexible pricing systems for NHI medicine procurement, what we see is there's some contradictions in the bill around the use of a single exit price dispensation. We do not believe that that is appropriate at the moment for various reasons, but particularly being that we are unsure as to what the benefit package would be, one, and two, how will that benefit package be procured in terms of medicine. So we do not believe at the moment the use of the single exit price mechanism will be appropriate for the NHI funds procurement of medicines, and that we believe that this should be removed from the bill as it stands. The bill talks quite a lot about procurement and ensuring value for money, and obviously we're bound by the PFMA and other regulations. We then also submit that we do not see the SEP system fitting into that, or we are unsure on how it will fit into procurement within the current regulations. So what we believe is that a different flexible hybrid system is required, and then the underpinning reason for that is to ensure the sustainability of our system. Because if we can't have a sustainable pharmaceutical industry, we cannot have security of supply. And therefore, we do not want a winner-takes-all procurement system, because we do not believe this will secure our medicine supply for our patients. If we go forward into the underpinning rationale for the procurement of medicines, we believe that when medicines are procured by the NHI fund for the NHI benefit package, that it should not be based on EML medicines only, and that we do not believe that the medicines procured today should be less than what is envisaged in NHI. So for us, we need some explicit guidance around what will be procured, how it will be procured, and then additionally, that medicines are not only procured on an EML basis or an essential medicines basis, because we believe to treat the underlying disease burden of South African patients, we need to purchase more medicines, not just EML medicines alone. And the underlying clinical reasons for that would be, what do you do with a patient who's unresponsive to either an EML medicine or a formally listed medicine, or where they do not respond to treatment? And the formulary list is explicit. What do you do then when a patient requires something beyond the formulary? So we do not believe EML-based procurement only is the basis of the NHI package. And additionally, we see a situation where innovative medicines which are coming to market should be included in the NHI benefit package and included in the NHI formulary. And therefore, we cannot have a situation of EML only being the basis of medicine procurement, because innovative medicines come to market quite regularly and often, and we know that EML medicines have been available to patients for many years and are often gold standard treatments, and therefore we believe an EML plus is required for NHI medicines procurement. If we go further in looking at the formulary and essential medicines, obviously evidence-based medicine should be the basis of formulary-based decisions. We need to recognize that the national drug policy gives us guidance in terms of how to develop these formularies. But our concern is, how do we deal with exceptions where patients are not responsive or have failed on the formulary treatments? What process does the NHI fund then follow to treat these patients with non-formulary listed products? And this needs to be resolved within the NHI bill. So our point here is that, you know, we do not want to see rationing of, one, the current benefit list. We see an enhanced comprehensive benefit package procuring more than EML medicines, and that patient medicine access must be progressive and not regressive, in line with our principles in the Constitution. If we move forward to looking at the Benefits Advisory Committee, our submission here is that we need explicit governance, explicit processes, and explicit guidance that ensures when the benefit package is released or designed that we are clear why things were included and why things were excluded, and that in the inclusion process, new technologies and innovations should be included in the benefit package as a principle, so that patients could get access to treatments that can improve their outcomes and improve the health outcomes for South Africa. Underpinning that, in terms of managing costs, we obviously believe that we need choices of generic medicines, because there are benefits to the use of generic medicines, and that we should ensure that we are not rationing levels of care beyond or below what's currently available. So in summary, around the Benefits Advisory Committee, the bill must be specific in terms of which factors the BAC will consider for inclusion, and give specific reasons or explicit reasons what was included or what was excluded and for what rationale. And to go a step further, is there some contradictions in the wording of the bill around comprehensive benefits versus medically necessary treatments? So these two terms need to be defined a bit more explicitly so that we can be sure as to what does comprehensive mean in terms of medicines and what does medical necessary mean in terms of medicines accessed by South African patients. If we go to the Office of Health Procurement, what we want to do as the PTG, we really want to engage with this entity to ensure that procurement for medicines in particular is managed on a sustainable, hybrid, flexible pricing model. And we're happy to work with this entity once established so that we can work through a process that ensures that sustainability of our sector. So we believe this entity will be very important and needs to be the overarching entity that ensures the procurement of health products is done in an explicit, clear manner that allows the sustainability of our sector when prices are set or medicines are procured. So this is a very important entity that we believe should play a good role within the NHI fund. We really believe in the right of prescribers, and this is doctors, to prescribe the appropriate treatments. And if a doctor needs to do what they believe is clinically appropriate to improve the patient outcome, they need an ability to prescribe medicine outside of the formulary, yes, with specific requirements that they justify why it's being used. But the NHI should NHI fund and benefit package should recognize there will be situations where patients require outside of formulary medicines where justified, and that this process needs to be explicit and needs to be implemented in a way that is easy to use and does not become a barrier to access, so that the prescribers can prescribe what they feel is appropriate for that patient in a justifiable manner. So again, we do not want medicines rationed through a cumbersome process where the prescriber cannot prescribe what they feel is appropriate for their patient. If we look at one of the key issues for us is what is the business case for ensuring sustainability for our sector within the NHI fund? We do believe that patients should have an opportunity to purchase complementary health insurance. This sector currently provides a cross-subsidy between the public and private sector where we're able to compete in both sectors because the private sector is available to us outside of the procurement of the current public sector medicines. And that, again, as Stavros was saying, that we need to recognize the cross-subsidy between these two sectors because that cross-subsidy allows us to be sustainable in the long term. So for us, we're at an interesting point because the bill says that the lowest price procurement is envisaged, but lowest price procurement is often, more often than not sustainable, even if the volumes increase. And you can look at the situation in China at the moment as one of those situations in terms of healthcare procurement. So for us, lowest price procurement is not sustainable, even if volumes increase, and that we want to go further, that one of the considerations in terms of developing the NHI package needs to be the sustainability of industries, and that we also allow space for the generic sector to grow, flourish, because we believe that's appropriate in the South African market. Okay. So for us, in terms of supporting complementary health insurance, this is very important for us, and we believe that patients should have the choice to procure treatments which are not covered by the NHI fund on a voluntary basis within a complementary healthcare insurance environment. I hand over to Rulani.
Hi, thank you, Gavin. I hope everyone can hear me. I think our colleagues have actually illustrated some of the concerns and some of our key submissions. I think what we'd like to say is that when we move on to the implementation side of the bill itself, I think it's important for us to recognize that we need to look at the milestones rather than just the time period that actually proceeds the implementation of the bill itself. because I think it's important to recognize that there are challenges along the way, and we need to take things as things become more concrete and much more clearer for us. So depending on the milestones that we achieve along the way, then that's when we need to move on to the next steps. So I think it's very, very important for us to really strengthen the health system first, achieve the things that we want to achieve within those initiatives that we have indicated that are important to move on to the next steps. While the implementation is also taking place, I think it's important to safeguard the Bill of Rights for all of us as patients, because I think one of the things I've indicated before to some of our team members is that we're discussing NHI as if we, the people and the committee members that we're discussing here, we're not the patients. We are also patients. So how do we safeguard our rights together as those of everyone else across the country while in the implementation of NHI? I think it's important that we safeguard some of the rights that we continue to have. And that, in a way, actually ensures that we continue to have access to some of the healthcare benefits that we currently enjoy without regressing, as some of my colleagues have indicated, into getting an option that currently is not working versus what we currently have. So NHI really needs to be something that really allows for us to achieve all of these things. And the implementation process, I think, is a very, very important one, because it needs to be really be data-based, that implementation process, evidence-based. Are we achieving some of these? And then I think more importantly, to bring out what Stavros was indicating earlier, the public-private partnership will be critical on how we achieve some of these milestones, because the public sector on its own and the private sector on its own, without civil society involvement in this initiative, we're not likely to succeed as a country. I think if all of us are really looking in the same direction, I think we really need to take an implementation process that's really based on milestones, and also to look at some of these interventions that have been indicated in the Presidential Health Compact, because those interventions in the Health Compact have been discussed by multiple sources, multiple stakeholders rather, to get to some of those things. And those things have timelines and they have milestones that need to be achieved within those timelines. And I think it's a good guide on how we can actually implement a program such as the NHI. The fund itself, I think we said, you have money in one side at the moment. How do you actually get the right balance? So the fund really needs to be sufficiently liquid before the full implementation. And how do we achieve that without really rushing to find ourselves that we don't have any funding for some of the critical or primary care initiatives that we want to implement with the NHI bill? Gavin, if you move on. So as a result, I think what is important for us, while we safeguard patient outcomes, I think we really want to conclude with this, that the single-payer, single-purchaser model will create disruption in the industry that is not actually intended for, because security of supply for pharmaceuticals has actually been demonstrated, especially with the pandemic where we are. That is actually a critical thing for us to make sure that it exists. So the single-payer, single-purchaser model, we do not believe it has the PTG that will really provide us with that sustainability and also security across the industry to ensure that we actually meet the needs of what we are trying to do for South African patients. The flexible hybrid pricing framework really enables us to be able to access multiple patients and also multiple medicines while understanding that patient access and outcomes are actually important, because not everything will be the same. And as a result, this flexibility will offer something like that, which is also something which also the health market inquiry actually was able to identify to say that the country does need some kind of flexibility in the way it does its pricing. The rationing, I think my colleagues have indicated quite a lot on this, that at the end of the day, what is currently existing, can it be maintained that we don't find ourselves where we have a lower standard with the NHI versus what we currently have? So let's not compromise on patient care and outcomes, because I think at the end of the day, that is how we're going to be judged in terms of the ability for us to achieve better patient care and better patient outcomes. So at the end of the day, the last point that we have here is that we really support complementary healthcare insurance because it will really bring sustainable patient access to treatment, sustainable healthcare sector, improved healthcare outcomes, and lower out-of-pocket systems payments. And when you start talking about universal healthcare across the world, it really touches on those things that patients are well taken care of. The healthcare system is thriving because everyone else is actually getting the fruits of what the system has put in place. The health outcomes of that system is actually much more positive. And you're also having patients and the civil society within that specific country actually having lower out-of-pocket payments. So I think for us as the PTG, we believe that today and subsequent and previous engagements are really as part of a good conversation for us to be having, which really allows all stakeholders within the healthcare system to be able to put together a package through negotiation, through discussion, to really understand on how we can have a sustainable healthcare system that provides access to healthcare to patients in South Africa so that we're better off than where we are, and all of us are actually benefiting across. So I will hand over there. I think that's the conclusion from the PPG. Let me hand over back to Stavros. Thank you.
Honourable members, Rulani and Gavin, thanks very much for that. Our concluding remarks are as follows. Firstly, we again wish to thank the committee for this opportunity to engage you on what is one of the more, if not the most significant social imperatives that our country faces. The context of that is very clear given the current events that we're experiencing in our country. By way of conclusion, there are three final points we wish to make. The first is our country is a unique country, and it requires unique solutions that are South Africanized. In arriving at those solutions, we do look, of course, at international best practice. We've attempted to do that in this presentation, but we also need to look at what works for us here in South Africa with our own set of unique circumstances. It is in that context that we've had a look at the bill from a pharmaceutical industry perspective, and our views have been clearly expressed in that regard as to where we would sit with the bill in its present form and also how we would move forward with respect to ensuring both sustainability and security of supply of medicines, which we consider to be one of the most important, at least, interventions in healthcare optimization and outcomes. The second point we wish to make is, of course, another unique aspect of our country is the ability to sit around the table to find solutions to even the most vexing and taxing of challenges. Universal healthcare coverage presents one of those vexing and challenging situations. We are confident that sitting around the table and incorporating all the various inputs of the various sectors and arriving at a common point which works for the country is the optimal way to go. My third and final point is, of course, just to re-emphasize again that pharmaceuticals are an enabler to both achieving optimization of public health outcomes on the one hand, but also on the other hand, the pharmaceutical sector is a critical sector in terms of the economic prospects of our country. Balancing lives and livelihoods has come through strongly in recent months. The pharmaceutical industry is at the center of that. So a sustainable industry that is able to continue supplying both solutions, current and future solutions for patients, is a critical aspect of that. It's been said time and time again that the most important public health and economic intervention right now in our country is to vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible. We can only do this, of course, if there is ongoing sustainability to the pharmaceutical industry. It is with that I conclude, honourable members. by saying that universal coverage is supported, but we would not like to see an imbalanced perspective that either diminishes or hampers security of supply of medicines going into the future. Thanks very much. It's been a great honor and a privilege to present to the committee. We are now open for any questions, and I hand back to the chair. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nicola. Honorable members, those of you who have not posted your desire to ask questions, don't post them anymore. I have only six names, and you have to just shout-chain the platform for you to ask questions. We hope that, Mr. Nicola, next time we meet you, you would have improved in your representation so that we don't see a male-only representation in leadership of your organizations. We wish you that well. Number two, fundamentally, something that was said by the first slide presented by Rulani, I would prefer to call him by his first name because I don't know whether I could pronounce his surname well. You'll have to educate me well. I found that to be the fundamental major difference that you have with the sponsor of this bill. It says, and in your, if I quote the actual verbatim, what you read in there, the underlying health system strengthening initiatives need to be completed before full implementation of NHI scheme. I would wish that when you do answer our questions, you come to probably modify. I would rather say to be completed before full, because the full implementation, you have to educate me and some of us, which country are you learning this from, where they had to complete and get everything sorted out, which are their challenges in strengthening their systems before they moved on to NHS or to NHI or any of their programs. But let me then give you the members who are going to be interacting with you in the following order. First one, Honorable Hlengwa. Number two, Honorable Gela. Number three, Honorable Chirwa. Number four, Honorable Munyai. Number five, Honorable Ismail. And number six, Honorable Dr. Harvard. Any other member who has not appeared in this list and would like to give, don't go into the platform now. Just raise your name here. I'll then have to note you.
Thank you, Chair. I raised my hand, but it's fine. I raised it here now. Thanks, Honorable Jacobs.
Yes. Thank you. Any other hand? So we will go with those seven hands. You start, Honorable Hlengwa, and the number two will come after you until number seven, who would be Honorable Dr. Jacobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Dinangwe. Greetings to the members of Portfolio Committee and to the panels. And I wish to acknowledge the presentation. It was very detailed and understandable. Thank you for that. I have one question to the PTG. The PTG industry will be one of the biggest beneficiaries under NHI. It will have to increase its supply of medicine to accommodate millions of new consumers in the healthcare sector. These new consumers will find themselves able to access healthcare under NHI. My question is this: how does the PTG plan to use its benefits under NHI to contribute to transformation in the supply of medicine in South Africa as a whole? Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson and members, and also the presenters. Let me first welcome the presentation. I'm having questions that I want to ask. My first question, you have proposed that rationing of NHI benefits will compromise patient care. and health outcomes. The only section that in the bill that makes a reference to rationing is section 39, subsection 5, requesting reasons from providers for rationing. Can you explain where in the bill is it stated that benefits will be rationed? My other question, where or what is the written, what is written in the bill that gives a PDG a sense that the security of the healthcare provisions and medicine supply will be threatened or not sustained? Have you got examples as to where this has happened in the world? My last question, given lack of a support of single payer, single purchaser, which comes with a benefit of economies of scale, how will ensure that we gain benefits of competitive prices of medicine if we continue with a fragmented purchasing method? Thank you very much, Dilengwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. It was very concise. I just want clarity on what then is proposed for the pricing, if single pricing of medicine isn't necessarily adequate and is problematic. And I also want to ask if there is research done on this particular issue to be forwarded to me through email for further reading, because I heard the reasons that you guys stated why it would be problematic, but I want to know if there's other research that has been conducted in relation to this particular part. And on top of that, just please give us what the proposement or the proposal is for pricing, if single pricing isn't adequate. Thank you.
Is Honorable Munyai not aware that he's coming after Honorable Chirwa?
I'm here, Honorable Chair. My first question, Honorable Chair, is as follows. I wrote my notes here, Chairperson. The first question is that you made... I just want to get my notes very well, Honorable Chair.
I know you might have lost your notes. I am happy to come back.
You can pass me. I'll come back just now, Chairperson. I'm trying to reorganize myself.
Please do. Honorable Ismail.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the presentation. I just have a few clarity-seeking questions, please. My first question, what are the key features of the NHI that will result in more equitable access? So concern we are having is that, you know, it will further widen the inequality gap due to the accreditation system. What are your thoughts on this? My second question, on slide 5, you state that rationing of the NHI medicine benefits to lower than current patients' benefits will compromise patient costs and health outcomes. Can you please elaborate on this? What do you mean by rationing of medicine benefits, and how do you foresee this actually having a negative impact on health outcomes? My third question, I think this was mentioned before by my previous colleagues, but I just want some more clarity, please. In slide 6, you mentioned that the single-player, single-purchaser model will negatively impact job creation and economic growth. In what ways do you foresee this having a negative impact? I think what we're asking for is much more clarity on this matter. My fourth question, I've gathered that you support a more hybrid system. Do you believe that a hybrid system will be more effective in creating equitable access to healthcare? And how will it actually improve health outcomes? I know you've touched on this, but I just need more clarity, please. My first question, in what ways do you foresee the fund being vulnerable to corruption? My sixth question, in your view, How sustainable is the single purchaser model? What do you foresee? What outcome do you actually foresee with this model? And my last question, if the NHI stands, how do you foresee the quality of care? It can be argued that it will create equal access, but what are your views on the quality of healthcare access with this bill? You've touched a little on this, but I'm asking for more clarity going forward because we all say that we agree on universal healthcare, but the NHI bill as it stands, and your view on it, especially to what I've just highlighted. Thank you, Chair.
May I go back now to Honourable Munyai? Or maybe I should pass?
Yeah, to Jacob, then I'm coming, yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Havard, come through.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the presentation. I have two questions. Number one, what's the value of the top therapeutic area in the private sector? Because PTG have only given a value of this in the current public sector. Second one, can you explain what the 500 medicine molecules include? And do they include generics as well? Thank you.
Dr. Jacobs?
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, and good morning to everyone. Thank you very much for your presentations this morning. I have a number of questions which I would like to ask Chairperson. So my first question is, let me just have a quick look here. I'll be with you now, Chair, just a little bit of pre-indulgence. You have made recommendations about continuity of care, and phased implementation of the NHI. Now there are two sections which actually speak about this in the bill, sections 57 and sections 33. With section, I just need to know whether what your views are on these two sections in specific relation with what I am raising here. That section 57 clearly outlines that there is a phased implementation of the NHI, and section 63 states that only once the NHI has been fully implemented, medical schemes may offer complementary services only. And then my next question, Chair, is about the hybrid system that was mentioned by PTG. They mentioned that when it comes to purchasing of medicines, they talk about it, about the hybrid system when it comes to purchasing of medicines. The question is, what about a hybrid methodology around utilization, meaning between the public and the private sectors, especially given that the current status quo will no longer be able or be in place, where no differences will exist between the public and private sector, or will be anticipated to be between the public and private sector. My next question is, talks to a concern that was raised about the NHI maybe jeopardizing the pharmaceutical sector. They also refer to the interdependence between the patient and the provider as well as the supplier. Can they please clarify whether it is their view that the NHI should regulate the prescribing practice, the model, or the standard international and national protocol, the accredited healthcare providers, to ensure certain practices will ensure the sustainability of the pharmaceutical industry? My next question, Chair, is they believe that advancing and expanding access to healthcare as provided for in Section 27 of the Constitution is regressive. And a very last one, if time frames are not acceptable for implementation of the NHI by the PTG, Is it acceptable to achieve a percentage of milestone measurement so that we do see a transformation of the healthcare system in our country? Thank you very much, Chair. Those are my questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Yes.
My first question is the following. Given lack of support of the single-payer, single-purchaser system, which come with benefits of the economic of scale, how will we ensure, or the presenter ensure, that we gain benefits of competitive price of medicines if we continue with fragmented purchasing method? That's my first question. The other question is the following. The NHI bill suggests that the establishment of the number of key structure, including the benefits advisory committee, as well as pricing committee and the stakeholder committee. The bill allows for the inclusion of the persons with technical expertise in medicine. Are you in agreement that the inclusion of the pharmaceutical sector in these committees will be adequately represent your interest? The other question, Honorable Chair, will be, given the budget allocation will inform purchasing behavior, what does the PTG proposal be done to replace EML and formulary systems which are currently in place? The other question, Honorable Chair, will be as follows. Is it acceptable that the details of how the BAC will set its criteria in written in regulation and not in the bill? Will that be helpful in the process? How does the PTG see the hybrid pricing framework being part of the transparent pricing system, which is embedded with S22G of the Medicine Act? So those are the questions, Honorable Chair, that are put forward before the PTG representative.
Thank you, Honorable Muna. Let me then just add my few on the list of questions colleagues have asked. One, just piggybacking on the one that was asked by Honorable Gela and Ismail, I would be happy, this is about the rationing of the NHI medicines. I would have been happier if the PTG were to say we would like to be considered in the Benefits Advisory Committee because your presentation is assuming that what we have is actually appropriate for both public and private. We are not giving a benefit of doubt that you will want to form part of this Benefits Advisory Committee to set up a benchmark medicines benefits package, because somebody will argue that what is actually there, you probably have to get a benchmark that is agreed upon, and then you can take it from there. That was just to amplify some of the questions that were asked by my colleague. But one that I would like to raise also with you is based on Section 38 that talks about the roles and responsibilities. Now, you have introduced a phrase that talks about flexible pricing framework. Now, this is all embedded on these various committees, the Benefits Advisory Committee, the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee, the Office of the Health Products Procurement. Now, if you consider all that, which is actually input in there, the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee, that will also be supporting this Office of the Health Products Procurement on pricing matters as indicated in the Section 26 of the bill. Does this not address probably the flexibility pricing framework that you are probably proposing and they wish to have? The second part, you have mentioned that access should be allowed to new technologies and innovations based on value assessments. Maybe you then have to actually check if it is not fully covered, this under section 57.3c, which outlines that as part of transitional arrangements, the Ministerial Advisory Committee on Health Technology Assessment will be established to regularly review a range of health interventions and technology by using the best available evidence on cost effectiveness, allocative production, and technical efficiency. Maybe you could explain if you probably don't think this actually has adequately covered you. There is a part that you are talking about, the third question, that you are talking about the large market for supplies of medicine. Now, we are aware that there's a large market supply of the medicines via various NGOs. How does the PTG propose that we account for this NGO sector? The last question, last but one, that was asked by, I think, Honorable Munyai, and it actually made me to read, I think Honorable Munyai or Dr. Jacobs, it made me to read just one part of section of the section 27 of the Constitution. It says, everyone has a right to have access to healthcare services, including reproductive healthcare, sufficient, all that is written there. Now, you will have to educate me how you then find that section of the Constitution being retrogressive. I also got a bit of a surprise when I heard you mention that. And therefore, I thought I would need your support in understanding. My last question would be the transparency in the pricing of medicines, which I think is one of the important aspects which was introduced through the Medicines Act, and in particular, introduction of the single exit price. How does the PTG propose we ensure transparency in our health while at the same time we remove this model? Thank you very much. You then can assist us with responses. Thanks.
Okay, Honorable Chairperson and members, thanks very much for that. We have close on 40 questions. And in the remaining 12 minutes, I think the best way to address it is to address some of the key thematics that have come through. And I'll ask some of my colleagues to respond directly to some of the thematics. I think the first thing, Chair, we take on board your comments about the representation of the presenters. We will certainly endeavor to look at that and be more gender representative next time. But I will say for the members, Malibongwe and Igamalan Kozigazi. That's sort of the first issue. The second issue is a common thematic has been the rationing of medicines, the access issue in terms of the constitution, and the flexible pricing model. I'm lumping all of those together, and I'm going to ask Gavin to come in and respond to those. So, Gav, if you can come in, let's just address that first, and then we'll come to the next thematic after that.
Thanks, Navras. Thanks, honourable members, for your comprehensive questions. I think we appreciate them in terms of the conversation. To tackle the first question around hybrid pricing models or hybrid flexible pricing model, is the implication we get from the bill as currently drafted is that lowest price winner takes all tender seems to be the preferred mechanism of medicines procurement. We don't think that's appropriate because in our view it won't be sustainable. So what we propose is a situation where certain types of medicines are procured on a certain basis, so where there are multiple manufacturers for a medicine, where a lowest price can be secured, a tender mechanism, not unlike what we have today, could be required. We then have innovative medicines where there's a sole supplier, where that innovation needs to be procured on a different basis because having a tender for only one supplier doesn't make logical sense. So then it needs to be a negotiation between the company and the NHI fund or the procurement office. Then there's going to be certain medicines where the level of evidence is not mature yet to clearly demonstrate the value of the product through an HTR process like Honorable Hendricks has mentioned. Those medicines need to be procured on an evidence-based arrangement or an outcomes-based arrangement where, for instance, in the UK, their cancer program works on that basis where a new innovative medicine comes to market, its value is not completely clear because the data is immature, and then NICE procures that medicine based on outcomes that can be demonstrated through the use in the population to address an unmet need. So this gives you an indication of what we believe hybrid or a flexible hybrid medicines procurement system or pricing system should be looking like in the NHI fund. And Honorable Chuba, there is some international literature we can send you on these hybrid flexible pricing arrangements. Our belief in terms of rationing is we are unclear on what comprehensive benefit package looks like. And we understand the balance between the bill and the regulations, which will give us more explicit insights later. But we are concerned that we cannot today say that NHI, from a procurement of medicines point of view, is going to procure more medicines or less medicines. And this is the concern we raise around rationing. We don't want to compromise patients who are currently in the public sector on a treatment, and that treatment may fall off, or patients in the private sector on a treatment, and that may not be available to the NHI package, and that member may not be able to afford a complementary health insurance package. So the rationing comment we make is in relation to the uncertainty around the comprehensive benefits and medical necessity as described in the presentation. We do not make the assertion that NHI is regressive versus Section 27 of the Constitution. So just to clear that up, that is not what we're saying. What we're saying is we don't want the benefits package to be regressive versus what current patients are being treated with. So I think there's a misunderstanding of the intention of that comment. It's not to be regressive in terms of Section 27 of our Constitution. In terms of just addressing Honorable Hendricks around health technology assessment, yes, we believe health technology assessment is required as long as it's independent and done on an explicit basis. In other words, we know the rules of inclusion or exclusion. Maybe to go a bit further around inequity, Honorable Klingwa started with the pharmaceutical industry will be a net gainer in NHR. At the moment, we cannot say that that is the case because we are unsure what the benefit package will look like. So we cannot do assessment to say if the total South African market for medicines was 100, that in an NHR setting, it would be 120. That is unclear to us, so we're not quite sure whether there's a net gain from a pharmaceutical industry point of view. Honorable Hendricks and Honorable Monwai, we do agree that inclusion on the Benefits Advisory Committee is appropriate, that pharma is representative on that committee, and that will be helpful for us. So we would support that. In terms of a different model to EML, so what we need to do is reconcile the underlying burden of disease and healthcare needs of both sectors to establish what medicines would be required. So in our view, it's EML plus. Going forward, it's not doing away with EML. It's taking a broader view across the whole of the South African patient population to meet the unmet needs. So it's EML plus from our point of view. In terms of NGO purchasing, our understanding is that, yes, there are some NGOs that provide medicines into South Africa, but that sector is marginal and quite small versus total procurement by the provinces and the national department. So those purchases should be factored into the NHI fund. We agree with you. But in terms of quantum and how it should work, we leave that to the fund to establish because it's quite small in the greater scheme of things. Stavros, I'm going to maybe stop there. If there's something you want me to specifically comment on, I'm happy to do that.
Gavin, I think in the interest of time, we only have 6 minutes left, so I think you've covered that all very well.
We'll add you another 4 minutes if you wish. Yeah.
Chairperson. Appreciated. Let's then, in the remaining 9 minutes we've got, let's address two or three other thematics that came out. I think the first one is around the benefits of economies of scale and what does this mean exactly. Gavin, you've partly touched on that. And I'm also going to cover the aspect of why we made a comment, Honourable Ishmael raised this, this could negatively affect the pharmaceutical industry and the growth in the pharmaceutical industry in its present form, the bill that is. So let me say firstly, to reinforce something we made during our presentation, that the pharmaceutical sector, together with the medical equipment and devices sector, is the only one that provides products to both the public and the private sector. It's not like the hospital sector or the medical scheme industry, who are only, they only reside and do business in the private sector. We are very different. We do business in both private and public sector. So what we believe, the perception that you will suddenly get a doubling of the volume or a growth in the volume, that is not necessarily true by our assessment, because there's already extensive volume that resides in the public sector. So if you were to combine the volume of the private and the public sector, you're not going to get a significant growth by our assessment of the economies of scale or the volumes in our country. It's very different if we were not in the public sector. You said, look, we're going to add another 40 million patients to your business. That would be a very different scenario. That is not the scenario, however, that exists currently. So there's not sufficient accretive benefit, we believe, in economies of scale that will be derived from a future single payer, single purchaser system, because this already exists. The impact, however, of combining the two and defaulting to a particular position on the two is that you could be disrupting what I referred to earlier as this cross-subsidy that currently exists between the private and the public sector. The public sector has got amongst the lowest prices in the world at the moment. So it's a very efficient system at procuring medicines in the public sector. And we are concerned that a disruption of that could mean that you could possibly and potentially have certain medicines that are no longer viable to keep in the market. We've seen that in other markets like New Zealand, for example, where you defaulted to this unitary system, or single system, that a number of medicines became unavailable in New Zealand vis-a-vis what you had in Australia, just by way of example. The concern there, of course, is that the health outcomes and the health metrics that you measure a nation by also become affected in that instance. Furthermore, if certain medicines or categories become unsustainable, it also disincentivizes companies from wanting to introduce new medicines into the market. And ultimately, in the medium to long term, your health system doesn't benefit from that. In fact, it gets prejudiced because it's no longer economically viable to sustain certain companies and or products in the market. So I think that is the point that we're trying to make here, is we're exceedingly concerned. If you just have a single-payer, single-buyer system, it does disrupt the dynamics of the pharmaceutical market and industry in our country. And that's the concern, I think, that we were trying to demonstrate there. with that point. Let me move on to one of the other thematics. Honorable Anna Jela mentioned about security of supply in an example of where this happens. So hopefully I've given some demonstration of that. I think we're happy to engage on other further examples of that. But I think the point we were trying to make here today is that we require a uniquely South African solution. And part of that solution resides in where we are presently between the private and the public sectors. Let me move on to the next thematic. Honourable Hubbard, you raised a question around the 500 molecules. Does it include generics? In fact, it is mainly generics. You also asked about the value of the top therapeutic category in the private sector. I'm going to ask Gavin to come in on that one. And then very lastly, I'm going to ask Rulani to comment on the question of transformation. And Honourable Senga, your specific question was pharma will be a beneficiary of the system. And how would that be, how would the gains be used to accelerate transformation? I'm going to ask Rulani to answer that one. Gavin, if you could come in on Honourable Hubbard's question on the 500 molecules in the meantime. Gavin, we seem to have lost Gavin. Okay. Let's take Rulani and then I'll answer in place of Gavin.
Liam's writing, eh?
Yeah,
Liam's looks writing on Friday.
I know.
Honorable Dr. Jacobs, mute your phone. Come in, Mr. Nicola.
Okay, Rulani?
Stavros, so thanks. So Honourable Chair and Honourable Tango, I think your question is around transformation of the introduction of NHI and how pharma is likely to drive that transformation. I believe what we believe is that the availability of more medicines in the, if you look at the two splits between 500 and 1,000, what we're saying is that we don't look at it more explicitly that the 1,000 moves over to the 500 and the 500 over to the 1,000 molecules available within the two sectors. What we believe is it's somewhere there is a sweet spot in between. And that sweet spot really will firstly enable all of us to have things that allow for the private sector to access, which is the number of patients that are available. But also the public sector will also have access to something that the private sector that currently has. So the combination of that, I think what you will find is you will have a lot of generics within the NHI process. That's currently, that's how it seems. And the companies that are available in the country, which is your current local manufacturers, will be able to benefit from that perspective. Not only from a pharmaceutical point of view, but what you also have good quality healthcare across the board is that everyone else in the system is actually benefiting, which really helps in driving the health economy, but also health equity for everyone. Because at the moment, it does seem as if the haves are actually benefiting and the have-nots are not actually benefiting. So I think what the PTG is saying is let's implement a system that actually allows to have equality and equity across all both sectors, which is public and private market. Over to you, Stavros.
Thanks, Rulani. The last
Mr. Nicola, in the last 2 minutes, you'll answer that question, but also make this correction. We don't have a Hendrix in the platform. Now, there's a question you answered. You said it was from Hendrix, Honorable Hendrix. And number two, the other member, you answered the question well. She's Gela, G-E-L-A, Gela, not Gela. Okay. But just please for us this other question you answered for Hendrix, and then finish in the next minute and a half.
Thank you, Chair. In fact, I didn't say Hendrix. I said Harvard. Honourable Member Harvard is who I was referring to. So for that honourable member, just to answer directly, she said that we are generics included in the 500 molecules. In fact, the answer is that those 500 are made up significantly of generics. We will email the honourable member Harvard some more detail on that to be more precise on that. But just in the remaining time I've got, just to say it does include mainly generics. Our very last comment, Chairperson, is with respect to what you asked around medicine pricing transparency was the question. And in fact, the 2004 amendment to the Medicines and Related Substances Control Act, Section 22G, in fact, which introduced transparent pricing to the system, has been one of the most successful pieces of healthcare legislation in recent times. It has significantly managed expenditure in private sector pharmaceutical pricing and benefits. It has also introduced transparency in pricing through benchmarking and other instruments that are contained, either through the Pricing Committee Advisory or directly in the containment of Section 22G. So that is a very effective instrument, we believe, in introducing this transparency to the system. Of course, these prices are all benchmarked globally, and in fact, manufacturers are required at this point in time when they introduce a new medicine to make reference to benchmark prices. Honourable Chair and honourable members of the committee, we have run out of time. There are one or two follow-up emails I've taken detail, and we will reach out in that respect. But let me just say again, it's been a great honour and a privilege to interact with the committee, to thank you for all the work that you're doing for our country, particularly at this point in time. The pharmaceutical industry remains committed and poised to contribute on an ongoing basis to both the healthcare outcomes of our nation, but more especially now, when we are preoccupied with a vaccine rollout in our country and getting on top of this most pernicious pandemic, COVID. So thank you very much. Most appreciated.
Yeah, Mr. Nicolau and your team, thank you very much for those closing warm comments that you are making to this committee. We appreciate that a lot. Honourable members, I gave them 4 minutes more because their presentation was 41 minutes. So, in fact, they had saved themselves 4 minutes there. That's why I added up that 4 minutes. But, of course, it's encroaching on our next presentation. But we really had to give them their 4 minutes back. We had a lot of questions as members, which was actually appreciated, but very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Nicolau and the team. We will interact with you continuously as we do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honourable members, let us just stretch our legs as we now ask the next presenter to load their presentations and be given the sharing rights so that we start in the next 3 minutes. Thank you very much.
Recording stopped.
Okay, honorable members, let us complete our
recording in progress.
Let us complete our stretch a bit. We will then be starting in the next minute. Okay, we need to start. Can that member who is having a chat on a phone mute her phone? Then we can actually start. We now would allow the presenters to start their presentation. You have 45 minutes to present. Sorry for starting 5 minutes late. We had to just complete another presentation. You do have 45 minutes, and I hope that your name is pronounced properly, Sister Jenix. If it is not so, you will then correct us what you are called. You have 45 minutes presentation about NHI comments on this portfolio committee, and then we will, as members, interact with your presentation, and you will come back again to give your comments on that. There's a member who's persistently on this platform, but having not muted her phone. It's a she. Can she mute her phone and therefore ask to unmute when she is presenting to us? For now, we have only one person on the phone, and that is myself. And as I mute, I will also allow one other person from Sister Jennings to then take it from here. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity. My name is Norman Tillema. And thank you, Chair and honourable colleagues. Yes, you are correct. The name is Sister Jenix. If I may just ask if you can see the presentation.
We can see the presentation there.
Thank you. Thanks very much for this opportunity. So, we submitted our comments regarding the NHI bill towards the latter part of 2019. At that stage, I just wanted to clarify just where the name Sister Jenix come from. At that stage, towards the end of 2019, the company in South Africa was called Sister Jenix. Subsequently to that, there's been a global merger with Sister Jenix and with 3M. Hence, you will see the presentation slides are marked 3M. However, our submission is still under Sister Jenix, as that is still the legal entity in South Africa at the moment. My name is Norman Tillema. I'm the sales leader for Sister Jenix South Africa, and I will be joined by my colleague Mark Brand, who's independent consultant who assists us with often with health technology assessments and has got vast experience in the field that we will be discussing. Just a quick background on the company, Sister Jenix and 3M. I'm sure you've all know of 3M, the company. We are a global business, and we operate in many countries around the world, not just in healthcare, but in other sectors as well. I just wanted to put in the slide just to see where we are represented. From a South African point of view, yes, we are part of 3M Global. We have a manufacturing plant in Gauteng, in Ekurhuleni to be specific. We've got three offices on a national level, plus minus 200 employees in the four business units, ranging from healthcare to consumer safety and transportation. Sister Jenix, as the legal entity, is part of the healthcare business group. We manufacture and supply multiple products and services to the South African medical market, private and public, as well as to the SADC countries and sub-Sahara countries as well. We are also proud to be one of the top 50 most ethical companies in the globe for 8 years running. And maybe just as another point, that we are BEE compliant in terms of our business with government or with state. So what do we do? Cystogenics is, we believe to be, I'll put Cystogenics 3M, a world leader in wound care and related products. We have a rich history of innovation with products bringing to market since 1948, specifically in the wound care business. You know, started with, for a lack of a better word, maybe plasters, something like that, then into advanced wound dressings that might have either silver in it or povidone, iodine, etc. And then later in the 90s, Cystogenics stroke KCI at the time developed what we call negative pressure wound therapy, which revolutionized patient outcomes in terms of severe wounds and the quality of life that patients might receive. We believe that we deliver world-class products to every corner of our country currently. We supply innovative and transformative medical devices to the entire population, like I said, in both public and the private sector. Believe that everyone should have access to healthcare regardless of the funding mechanism. And when I talk about funding mechanism, it's not just through insurance companies as in the private sector, but also through the current government state business, as well as Department of Labor, COID, the Road Accident Fund, etc. So that's what I refer to as the funding mechanism. We believe that health economics matters. Most of the products that we bring to market has got a huge amount of clinical evidence behind them, as well as we do number of healthcare practitioner trainings, and they believe in the product, they can see the clinical outcomes for themselves, and hence that comment where we say that the cheaper product is not always the better product. We believe that we bring products to market for healthcare practitioners and caregivers, the products that they need with challenging scenarios in wound care, and then obviously that we want to restore people's lives. Our comments that we'll present to you by my colleague Mark are based in our experiences in the healthcare sector, including the Department of Transfer. We are referred to the Road Accident Fund, the Department of Labor Compensation Fund, private and public sector, where we render all our services. I can include military and South African police services as well. Our comments are based on our experience as a company, which operates in other countries as well, where we have an understanding of their health insurance models, either national or social health insurance or otherwise, and that the overarching principle in which healthcare should be provided is evidence-based medicine, ensuring that all patients are entitled to appropriate care based on research, considering not only costs, but obviously health and patient outcomes. With that, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Mark Brand, to go through our comments specifically. And once Mark is done, I'll go through one or two case studies with you just to share with you some of the technology that we bring to market.
Thank you, Norman. Good day, Honourable Chair. Good day, Honourable Members. Please allow me just to reconnect to this presentation. Thank you again. I'm going to continue from this point with specific comments to the submission made by Cystogenics, generalizing around the bill itself, the constitution and benefits. In terms of the right of access to healthcare and social security, and specifically sections 27 and 36 of the constitution, the bill would have to, in its application, limit the rights of individuals. This would also be the case in its gradual implementation. The question, therefore, is on what basis will the NHI fund, through entities such as the Benefits Advisory Committee, the Pricing Committee, and the Office of Product Procurement, make these decisions that would have to limit rights? No such principles to guide the limitations of rights are yet set out in the bill, and specifically in relation to the supply of medical devices. Furthermore, the limitation of rights must be evidence-based, in our opinion. By the inclusion of evidence-based medicine as the criterion on which the BAC and OHPP, and in the end their fund, make their decisions on formularies and treatment guidelines. Not only cost, i.e. the lowest possible price, as per clause 11.2e, but health outcomes must be considered. Here we speak about both clinical and cost effectiveness. The bill would create mechanisms whereby deviations and not a rigid complementary formulary is permissible by healthcare professionals and entities to act in the best interests of patients, in particular with complex wounds, the inadequate treatment of which could lead to sepsis, loss of limbs, and downstream escalation of costs. Here we talk specifically about evidence-based practice as well. Following the sequence of the bill, points 4 and 5, funding of the NHI and role of medical schemes. As many other stakeholders have no doubt expressed, we remain concerned as well about the financial sustainability of the fund. Very little is known as to how the NHI will be rolled out progressively, and if on a primary care basis, what would that mean for us as an advanced wound care company or supplier of such technologies, specifically in this business? For example, a patient who has suffered a workplace accident, a diabetic foot patient referred from a primary healthcare contracting unit, and patients suffering from burns. Would they be referred to tertiary institutions, and at what cost? So these are very specific examples to this type of business, and particularly with medical devices. How does the NHI accommodate this type of tertiary care beyond primary care within the NHI model? Medical schemes should not be limited to unknown complementary cover, as they alleviate pressure on the public sector and the NHIF in future. 2.6 in the submission, procurement, value and outcomes. With respect to evidence-based medicine and health outcomes, apart from the absence of entrenching evidence-based medicine and health outcomes in product procurement, are our concerns with a generalized clause in 38.6 with respect to direct delivery. This should be flexible enough to accommodate both, depending on the degree of sophistication and complexity and support required to support that particular device and delivery of care. Clause 41.3b suggests an all-inclusive fee to specialists and hospitals. Does that include products such as this, and if they are held accountable for outcomes? Clauses 38.6, 34, 4, 7C, and 8.2, formularies appear to be strict, yet with no room to respond to health needs if they fall outside of such lists. And referring to the previous slides, where in certain instances where certain degree of care and acuity would have to be escalated to the next level of care, is this accommodated beyond the primary healthcare model and within the current NHI model? Our proposal, therefore, is that formularies should be set out on an evidence-based medicine basis, and product lists must flow from the formulary. Consider all patients in the context of evidence-based medicine, also those with wounds that are difficult to manage, as referred to earlier. Health technology assessment will include all technology and inform clinical practice guidelines. I'll talk to HDA a little later. The BAC, OHPP, and NHIF must consult the bodies who are experts in wound care and which we list in our submission when making decisions on wound care protocols and the associated products and related products are used in this type of care. Provide payment mechanisms, not still quite clear yet in the bill, should ensure that providers are able to procure to address their patient needs. Again, consistent with the practice of evidence-based medicine. With respect to innovation, the bill is silent on how innovative devices will be adopted into the system. The introduction of new technologies constitute an important facet of healthcare service and delivery. These devices may provide treatment for previously untreated conditions or improve devices where other devices have failed or where there were no further treatment options for that particular patient. They may impact
overall length of treatments, fewer admissions, reduced length of stay, quicker recoveries, and overall improved quality of life and productivity in society. An example of an advanced wound device or advanced wound dressing would be where healing time may be reduced by up to 40% with these types of devices. That would have a direct impact on length of treatment, hospital stay, and consumption of resources. And further to that, it would allow the quicker turnaround of patients in hospital beds to allow any other patients access to those sought-after beds. So we support a mechanism for assessing and introduction of innovative technologies to ensure timeliest access by patients and specialists in their fields. This needs to be underpinned by health technology assessment. Talking to health technology assessment and point 9 and under 57.3D, which all collectively fall under transitional arrangements within the bill, just to revisit this, no doubt you're aware of it, the Ministerial Advisory Committee on Health Technology Assessment for National Health Insurance must be established to advise the Minister of Health Technology Assessment, and which must serve as a precursor to HTA agency that must regularly review the range of health interventions and technology by using the best available evidence on cost effectiveness, allocative, productive, and technical efficiency and health technology assessment. I would like at this point just share with you the actual global definitions for health technology assessment, both by the World Health Organization, as well as the more recent, and this subsequent definition goes way further than any previous definitions, just to illustrate the complexity and efficiency of the entire process to ensure access to quality health care. I want to just quickly go through the ISPOR definition. This is the International Society for Pharmacoeconomics and Outcomes Research. So HTA would suggest an evidence-based multidisciplinary process intended to support healthcare decision-making by assessing properties and effects of one or more new existing health technologies in comparison with their current standard. It is aimed at determining added value, where HDA uses explicit analytical frameworks to determine the value of a technology at different points of its life cycle, based on research and the scientific method in a systematic, transparent, and unbiased way. The purpose is to inform decision-making in order to promote an equitable, efficient, and high-quality health system. Moving further in the submission, HDA, therefore, should not be used as a mechanism to restrict access, but, and however, to promote access to quality and cost-effective healthcare by our entire population. HDA includes economic evaluation as one of the many assessment tools, where economic evaluation is referred to and alluded to specifically in the bill. This should be used with other equally important criteria to inform decision-making and not used in isolation as per the definition. We therefore support the establishment of an independent HTA entity as per the recommendations made through several initiatives addressing prioritization, management, and allocation of healthcare resources. And this stems and is based and founded on the health policy framework for technology regulation, first published in 1999, and subsequently through various different initiatives in the Department of Health, and collaboration with international organizations like NICE, etc. Quite a lot of work has happened subsequently in the last 10, 20 years. Such an HTA entity should, based on international lessons learned and successful HTA implementation, be independent, transparent, and multidisciplinary, embrace new and innovative technologies, providing a mechanism for rapid patient access. This is a link to the earlier comment on innovation, and include mechanisms for coverage with evidence development, where there's still relative uncertainty with regards the precise value one might extract from a particular technology. In our opinion, HDA should not sit within the NHI necessarily, as NHI cannot be both the producer and consumer of HDA recommendations. This could be naturally influenced by the perspective of NHI. There's nothing wrong with that, but there are many potential consumers of HTA, not least of all, as we have currently the Office of Standards and Compliance, the Council for Medical Schemes, hospitals, both private and public, in terms of their deliberations of purchasing equipment in this context, equipment being a medical device per se. So therefore, HTA should be fit for purpose in that it should be independent, avoid the bias of the owner, dependent on the life cycle of the technology, avoid a one-size-fits-all methodology. So therefore, we believe using an assessment process utilized currently for drug assessment could and would be inappropriate in many cases for non-pharma devices, and that non-pharma technology, that would include both devices and interventions. It should be adaptable and pragmatic and consultative. HTA should guide clinical practice, therefore, importantly, must be frequently updated. It's not a matter of conducting an HTA on a single technology and ticking a box and never revisiting it again. It is absolutely critical to be updated frequently. And lastly, balanced national and innovative and innovation priorities with respect to burden of disease on the one hand and access to best care on the other. I'd like to refer back to my colleague Norman. Norman, I'm just going to stop sharing and sure. You may continue with the presentation.
Thank you. I just need to find that presentation again. Please stand by. Thank you. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for that. And thank you, honorable colleagues. I'm going through a couple of slides just where we as a company or Sistergenix has brought innovation to market. It might be there's some pictures of patients who we have consent for. We've used these in case studies and in training sessions with healthcare practitioners and surgeons. It's not for sensitive viewers if you're a bit squeamish. So I will say when I'm going to start the first slide and I'll say when I've concluded when the pictures are finished should you wish not to have a look at these. The first case is where we've used our product called Vac Veroflow in terms of limb salvage or trying to save the leg. You'll see from the top slide the injury that happened to this child or young person. Obviously, it was then fixated, but by the use of our product, you can see at the bottom that within 3 weeks of using an external fixator, which is on there, and then the use of negative pressure wind therapy or Vac Veroflow, the patient's limb was saved. To be honest, if any other previous wound care treatments were used in this patient, there's a very, very good chance, 95% chance, that this child would have lost a leg. In the second case is a case that we sadly enough see more often with to do with a disease called necrotizing fasciitis. This was a case, a 57-year-old gentleman, actually during the World Cup in 2010, had to be severely debrided, as you can see. But after 11 weeks, this was the outcome, and the patient survived pretty well, and still currently to this day lives a good quality of life after chances of not being able to survive this disease. And unfortunately, we see this more and more in our country. The last case is burns. Unfortunately, for those of you who know, South Africa is known as the burns capital of the world, so to speak, for various reasons. This specifically is a case where an employee unfortunately sustained a chemical burn. We used Vac Veroflow, which is a new technology that's been on the market for about in effect from 2010 onwards, was treated, and this is the outcome 5 months post-treatment, which we believe is a very good outcome, and the quality of life of this patient is secure. So in conclusion, all three of these cases presented, so there's no more pictures for those of you who didn't see. The use of new technology, specifically VAC VeriFlow, supported the evidence-based medicine and clinical outcomes, improved the citizens' lives, and is, in severe cases, preserved limbs and even life itself. What seems or deems to be expensive right now will be cheaper in the long run. That concludes our comments, and I'll open it now to the floor. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for that presentation. Your warning for sensitive viewers. Let me just check because I was really hooked into your. Okay. Now I don't have any member who has indicated, so I will take all the questions here on this platform. Hold on, I'll take all the hands on this platform. I saw you just clicking in now. All must come in now. Let me take the numbers, the names of honorable members who want to interact.
Honorable Ismail Chair.
Ismail, you are number one. Any other?
Jacobs, Chair.
Dr. Ken Jacobs, number two.
Kela.
Honorable Kela, number three. Okay, if there are no takers, I'll try and maybe see if I'm number four. The following members have indicated their desire. Honorable Ismail, one. Honorable Dr. Jacobs, two. Honorable Kela, number three. Let's take them in that order, one after the other.
Maybe you are busy speaking.
Okay, start.
I said, not me, Chairperson.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for the presentation. I just have three questions. My first question, in what ways will the lowest possible price in clause negatively affect health outcomes? My second question, you are a global entity. Where else in the world have you seen this type of NHI model succeed? And my last question, how will this bill negatively impact innovation? Thank you.
Dr. Jacobs, in the
sorry, Chairperson, I was just struggling to unmute. In your presentation, you mentioned justification for any limitation of rights being included in the bill. Now, I want to actually ask you questions with regards to that statement that you made. And the question would be, do you appreciate that the Constitutional Court has extensive jurisprudence in the limitation of rights in Section 36 of the, as according to Section 36 of the Constitution? This is not inclusion in the legislation in particular. Now, I am of the view that these cases are available for you to study, and here we're talking specifically about the cases of limitation of rights and the justification thereof, and allow an understanding of what is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society. I would also be able to, apart from looking at this hopefully in the future, is also be able to express your view on this at the moment as we are on this platform. And then on your slide 5, the last point you're making on the cost, the policy and the bill make reference to evidence-based medicine and cost effectiveness. Why do you seem to be implying that this is not considered in the NHI bill? And on your slide 7, the bill sets the enabling legislative framework for establishing the NHI fund. And the principles which you refer to are more appropriately covered in the regulations rather than within the bill. And the regulations will be published once the bill is promulgated. It especially applies to the point raised on your provider payment mechanisms on slide 13 also. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Keller will be followed by Honourable Munyai.
Thank you, Dinangwe. My first question, you have raised concerned about the right of access to health care and social security and the limitation of rights. In your opinion, are there gaps within the bill where constitutional issues with regards to NHI implementation are not effectively addressed? I noticed that the bill's preamble states that NHI implementation is consistent with the constitutional commitment for the state to take a reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to achieve the progressive realization of the right to have access to healthcare services. Do this not address your concern? My second question, your recommendation that not only cost, but health outcomes must be considered by the fund. Thank you very much, Dinangwe.
Thank you, Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I was looking very closely to their presentation because it was not even long. One question that I want to put forward. There seems to be an assumption that complex cases and high-skilled personnel who are able to attend to the cases such as the wound care are not catered for in the primary health care model. Can they please clarify this important question? On the slides 17 and 18, there's no provision in the bill that says HTA will not be used to restrict access to services. Are you suggesting that there should be no internal HTA capacity in the fund? The fund must also have this capacity to be able to assess what is recommended and to inform other processes in the fund. Is it your view that what will work is only if we have a separate external entity? But then, why does this Cystagenics seem to be opposed to this? The other question that I want to put forward is that, given the myriad of the supplies and the supplies which are available in the health systems currently, of which some cannot be confirmed to be as effective, is the presenter suggesting that the health technology should not be used to enlist wound care products into the formulary list in the presenter has made reference to earlier? Currently, pricing and supply of the wound care product and suppliers are not in any way regulated. Will the presenter suggest that the status quo be retained or some form of regulation to be implemented? Honorable Chair, my last question is as follows. I'll be very quick, Honorable Chair. In your presentation, you mentioned justification for any limitation of right being included in the bill. Do you appreciate that the Constitutional Court has extensive jurisprudence in the limitations of the rights? I think Dr. Jacobs covers this in Section 36 of the Constitution. This is not for inclusion in legislation. I'm of the view that these cases are available for you to study and allow an understanding of what is reasonable and justifiable in an open and a democratic society. What are your comments on this, please?
Okay, you finish, Honorable Munyai.
Yes, I'm done.
Yeah, well, thank you. From my side, one of my other clarity-seeking questions is related to what Honorable Munyai has asked. There's a statement that you made in a presentation where you said, will burns be treated at the tertiary or whatever level? Now, I got confused there because firstly, you need to classify, clinically, you need to classify a burn. Is it a primary, secondary, whatever burn? Is it a 9%, 10%, 20%, 100%? Then you could also at least send it to the appropriate level. I do not understand what you mean, because you don't treat all burns at the quaternary or tertiary level. You classify burns and therefore send them to the appropriate level of care based on the assessment. So I just need clarity on that part, what you are saying. But number two, there is a program here. The NHI fund is envisaging, and it actually spells it very clearly on issues of Ministerial Advisory Committee, where it looks at the health technology assessment, HTA, that you have made reference to be part of that in a transitional sort of situation. Section 57, in fact, states that the health technology assessment will serve as a precursor to the health technology assessment agency, meaning it will definitely transit into another permanent agency matter. It's not going to sit permanently here within this initial arrangement. Is that not making you comfortable? Or maybe do you need to get more clarity on that part, or probably don't agree even doing that part of this situation? My second and the last is that your anxiety about NHI, that it will be rolled out and the role of the medical schemes is noted. But now, the Section 57 of the bill does allay your anxiety because it talks about the transitional arrangement again, which includes the phased approach in the implementation of the NHI, where Section 33 states that the role of the medical schemes will only be limited to complementary services once you have a fully established NHI, but you do accommodate the medical schemes during that period of transition. Are you not comfortable with that, which is also envisaged by the NHI? You can then assist us with your responses. Thank you.
thank you all. Sorry.
Chair? Yes, Honorable Kela.
So I'm so sorry, Chair. I didn't finish my second question.
Okay, let's take the Honorable Keller first before you reply. Thank you, Honorable Keller. Come to.
Oh, thank you very much, Chair. I'm so sorry for that. My second question, Chair, to the presenter, your recommendation that not only cost but health outcomes must be considered by the fund. Are you aware that health or quality outcomes is mentioned 35 times within the bill? For example, this consideration of health outcomes is in relation to accreditation, contracting, data collection, and payment of service providers. Where and how else would you prefer health outcomes to be considered within the bill? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Keller. Come back and then... Sister Genix to then answer.
Thank you very much. Before I think the majority of the questions will be hopefully be answered by my colleague Mark, if I can just ask the Honorable Ishmael, just if possible, I just missed your first question, if you can repeat that kindly, please.
Come again, Ishmael.
Thank you. In what ways were the lowest possible price close negatively affect health outcomes?
Okay, thank you for that, and for clarification. So, if I speak specifically to the one therapy that we provide, which is negative pressure wind therapy, the tendency by payers is to put various suppliers in the same category. For an example, saying an apple is an apple, but then obviously you get different types of apples and that some taste better, etc. So we believe that some of the products that we can provide are in effect superior than others, although that payers and procurement personnel will actually bundle them all together, and that it can be seen, well, you know, one therapy is the same as the other, is the same as the other. So we believe if an informed decision is not made in terms of what the products can actually do, that then it might be perceived that it will just go over to price and that the cheaper product will be procured. So I think it's from that point of view that we have a concern. In terms of your question, if it's anywhere else in the world, to be quite honest, not to my knowledge, or I am not aware, but I can definitely find out for you and I will revert in writing. And possibly your third question, Honourable Ishmael, is about how do we perceive that the NHR will negatively impact innovation. So, for example, if there's going to be a list such as in pharmaceutical with an emergency medical list or something like that, or procurement or a tender or formulary or some sort, when new technology comes to market, and specifically in the wound care space where new technology comes into market very quickly, we're just possibly concerned about the time it will take from when this new technology is available or in the market, and how quickly can we get it onto either a formulary or whatever the case might be to make it accessible to the public sector, to the public at large. So that was just a concern about the time period from bringing it into country and from effectively being used on patients. Mark, if I can hand over to you, please. Sorry, we're only two, so I couldn't write down all the questions that were asked.
Thank you, Norman. Thank you, honourable members. Yes, we'll do our best to try and address all of them. Yes, we do. I apologise if we do miss out on a few. I apologise in advance, but we will make every effort to respond in writing to those. Just to address honourable Jacob's
point on limitation of rights, just to start off with, I'd like to deliberate over that amongst colleagues
and get back to you and this committee in writing, if we may. Honourable Jacobs spoke, if I understood correctly, and asked whether we believe that cost effectiveness is not implied in the bill. We read a lot about
costs and lowest costs, etc. I would also like to ask for the opportunity to give you a more constructive response to that, and how we believe it could be made a lot clearer. Then coming to Honourable Gala, I think you made a point about cost and health outcomes must be considered. I make this point because we make a determination. First of all, we look at the technology in terms of the evidence that supports its performance. In other words, how effective it is, how well does it do against what a current standard of care might be. We talk in terms of cost effectiveness being different to costs. Again, I'm unsure if I'm answering this question, but nevertheless, when we talk about cost effectiveness, it looks at two components of the calculation, and that is naturally looking at for how much extra cost are you, for how much extra benefit are you getting extra costs. I could also address that more comprehensively in writing. It's a lot more technical than we are going to do justice to in this case. Honourable Gerda, you made a point about gaps in the bill. I couldn't quite get the rest of that question. If you may repeat it, if you're able to.
Maybe she could do that after you completed.
Yes, of course. All right.
Thank you.
Then, Honourable Chilindzi, I think that's who it was. You asked us, or you suggest we assume that advanced wound care is not available to available to the NHI. I think that's possibly how we read it. given the emphasis on primary healthcare. And typically this is not something that is found in primary healthcare, but rather at tertiary level and specialist care. And we heard the discussion about burns earlier on, and we saw examples about diabetic foot ulcers, which if left untreated will become chronic, and are left untreated or without the appropriate treatment can lead to worst case scenario amputations. Okay, and I think we need to understand that transitional component of the NHI from primary healthcare through to tertiary level care, and if this is included in the fund. The comment about health technology assessments within the NHI in the context of transitional arrangements. We don't just disagree with that, particularly if there's certainly a view to create an independent entity. You know, if the short-term strategy is to implement internally to actually get through the work, then it's difficult to argue with that. But having said that, there is a lot of work going on in industry already in this regard. I think where this possibly has a home is within the Benefits Advisory Committee, where they would take the outputs and recommendations of a health technology assessment process, whether internal or external, and then they'd make their determination based on that. I'm not sure if having it internal or external makes that much of a difference at the moment. But yes, I think we all agree and we are aligned with the necessity to have some form of formal health technology assessment and structured approach to this. I'm not sure. I think I'm on track. Last but not least, coming back to the Honourable Chair, I think you made a couple of points. Will burns be treated at primary or tertiary level? I think you were asking whether we believe that. I think you're absolutely right. It depends on what type of burns. I think when we get down to full thickness burns, maybe Norman, when I finished here, you could perhaps make a concluding comment in that regard, please.
Sure.
Yes, Honourable Chair, we would be comfortable if you're talking about transitional arrangements relating to HDA. But again, I can't see it making a difference if there's a sufficient amount of this work currently happening, whether you would need to build capacity internally to be able to do this, only to relinquish it to an external body to do this type of work in any case. And then the role of medical schemes, I would like to respond to that formally, if I may, in writing.
Are you able to switch on your mic, your video as you speak so that we can see you?
There we go, Honourable Chair. Yes. I apologize.
It's Norman here, just in case, referring to the question of the chair regarding burns. Yes, it depends on the severity of the burn, and let me be quite frank, the burns centers that we have in South Africa are, if I can say first class, is probably derogatory. I think it is world class. It is superb, specifically if you look at burns units at Baragwanath, Albert Luthuli, Bull Park, Red Cross. So yes, I think the suggestion would just be that that the knowledge that is gained there on the treatment of burns, which is often not wrongly diagnosed, we know it's a burn, but the severity of that same caliber of treatment is also done on primary level where possible, depending on obviously the size of the wounds and the severity of it. Often we see that in the primary sort of setting that just the basics are done for these patients that could lead to longer scarring or less quality of life down the line. It's basically a case of that the quality of the treatment that is available in your tertiary and in the burns units also then obviously scales down and trickles down into the primary setting. So, in other words, not to burden those tertiary sectors, so to speak, but we can treat those severe wounds in the primary setting wherever possible. And that's it from my side.
Is that all from the team?
That is all from me as well, Honourable Chair. Again, as I said, for whatever we've missed or could not respond to right now, we will get all of the questions and respond to them in writing.
No, thank you very much for interacting with us. We appreciate that. I may actually say I didn't see what was written for me by the parliamentary staff that we were all requested to switch on our videos. I'm glad we saw Norman's face too late, which is good. What you have in the background is very scary. It's much more scary than the wounds that we noticed. I don't know. I hope nothing is alive there behind you.
No, sir. It's just a picture of my favorite place that I would like to visit one day, the Kruger Park, if we're allowed to one day. So.
Okay. No. Next time. But the wound care and the organization we represent surely does have a lot of other very senior leaders who are females. Let's get them to meet and interact with us again next time we meet you. But I think you are doing a very good job, and some of us were learning something new from what you are presenting. Keep on doing what you are doing in our country, in the world. It makes a very big difference, healing those wounds and those bones and those muscles. I did not know you can treat that... what is that? The second patient you have, that fascia infection.
Necrotizing fasciitis, yes, Doc.
We are learning every day. Thank you very much. If there are any parting shots from you, we'll give you. We'll finish before your time. But if you are done, that's fine. But you can
no, thank comment. No, thank you very much, and I appreciate everybody's time and your valuable comments. Personally, I think you have a very difficult job. I think you're probably going to listen to a lot of presentations from other suppliers and institutions. I just want to say from a Cystogenics point of view, thank you for your time. Thank you that we could submit our comments and let us be heard. And I'm sure together, the whole medical fraternity, we can drive in its way forward in the way it is intended to be, to give everybody access to healthcare. So thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. We will get back to you on the comments that we couldn't answer.
Okay, that is great. Also, continue interacting with the Department of Health, because they are the other people who will be brought by us back when we are finishing off this bill presentation. We would like you to also continue engaging them and interacting with them. Thank you very much.
You
want to say something, Mark?
No, Honourable Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity as well.
Okay, greatly appreciated. Then you can have a good afternoon. Thank you very much. Honourable members, this team did well. They gave us some time. We will start at 12:45 with the next presentation. You can stretch your legs, make a cup of coffee, come back to this meeting. May I request that I have been informed that this process is going live on our parliamentary TV. So, honourable members, when you actually make a presentation now or ask questions, do switch on your video if you can. Don't mind that you don't look well shaven. Doesn't matter, but just switch on your video if you can. Okay, but we start at 12:45. Thank you. I think, honourable members, we can then start. I do notice that the presenters have logged in, and they are called BD. They'll tell us who is BD and what is BD. We have 45 minutes that is allocated to you, BD, to make your presentation on this platform to the members of Parliament in the Portfolio Committee of Health that are actually the ones to process the NHI bill. Your 45 minutes starts now. Thereafter, we'll interact with you with questions, clarity-seeking questions, and you can come back to interact with us on those questions. I will request you to switch on your microphone, your videos while you present, unless there are challenges. And we will then also ask honourable members, when you ask questions and you are in a spot where you may be able to switch on your videos, to please do so. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Ian Wakefield. First, it's a really great honour to be presenting to the Portfolio Committee. Thank you to Honourable Chair, but also Honourable Committee members for I think dedicating your time to what is really a critical space, healthcare. I think never before in the history of in my lifetime has healthcare been as front and centre as it's been in the last 18 months, where it's something that we're all living. It's on top of mind in terms of social conversation, because currently we are exposed as patients, we are providers and supporters in terms of what is currently happening with the COVID pandemic globally. And you see South Africa as part of this global healthcare ecosystem where healthcare is not localized to where you are as a patient, but as representative of what's happening on the global space. So it's a very critically important manner. And typically, as we're going with NHI, really key for South Africa in terms of how addressing equitable healthcare as a, from a societal point of view. Adela, next slide, please. Next slide, Adela. Adela.
Sorry, Ian, I'm just trying to move this slide. Seems like my screen is frozen. I'm just going to stop sharing for a second and then start again. Just give me a second.
Apologies for the technical glitch.
We'll wait.
I'm having trouble advancing, Ian.
Okay, maybe I'll look.
Can you perhaps share on your side?
Okay, I will share my screen.
Okay, apologies about that.
Can you all see?
Yes,
okay. Okay. So, again, thank you. As I said, firstly, just in terms of the, for the agenda this afternoon, I think for many of you, you may not be familiar with BD, so I would like to run you through who BD is, but also what are the spaces in healthcare that we play in. I'll present an overview from BD point of view as merely a medtech and an IVD company. How do we see our role within the NHI?
I don't know whether it's on my side only where I cannot hear you, Ian.
So let me see, I've got...
I can hear you.
Can anybody else hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you.
Can other...
is everybody, can they hear me clearly? Okay. As I said, provide an overview, introduction to BD is as a company, the spaces we play in. Then secondly, we look at broadly in the NHI, really focus on key area in terms of from a medtech as well as IVD perspective, and then some closing remarks. With me sharing the presentation this afternoon, I have with myself Avanti Governor-Bestos, who is head of BD's Regulatory Affairs Organization across Africa, and Adila Fakir, who is head of Public Affairs for Africa for BD. So firstly, who is BD? BD is a medtech company which operates in more than 190 countries with 70,000 associates across the globe. But we also, as I said, a company that's founded in tradition, founded in legacy, being around for an excess of 100 years. And what we're really proud of is really how we operate as a company, how we look to contribute to the society. So while we are large, how we operate is really critical, and that makes us one of Fortune most admired companies globally. Within the last, I would say, 10 years, we've also changed and evolved as a company, entering in new spaces. And that's come through acquisition of companies like Care Fusion and TR Bard, which means we've really focused from purely being a laboratory-focused company right into being interventional. And I'll give you some little bit of detail at what it means from a breadth of products, but also from a patient journey perspective, where BD plays a role across the patient journey all the way from primary health care, diagnostics, as well as in theater care. And really, while we pride ourselves in being a provider of healthcare solutions, but most importantly, very relevant in the spaces that we play in as a company. While we're a large global company, what is our presence in Africa, and how do we look to contribute to be an active, I would say, societal citizen within the South African context? Specifically in terms of our Africa organization, while we have a large organization within South Africa, we also have offices across East and West Africa, because we do see ourselves as part of the Africa journey to success in contributing to healthcare. And we do that in many shapes and forms from an organizational point of view. And I'll give you, I think in one of the other five presenters, we'll give you some perspective of what it means going forward. But also being a South African arm of a global company, how do we look to contribute to transformation? How do we contribute to be relevant? We do that in terms of being an inclusive workforce, being diverse in terms of makeup from a workforce perspective. Our board currently is 75% Black board members with 25% Black female. What is obviously critical for us, we recognize within the South African context, there's the need to be to making a contribution. We do recognize in the large members of unemployed society. So how do we contribute within that space? We have really much active targeted programs, for example, with Evolve University of Technology. We have a learnership program where we work very closely with them, and it's an accredited program working with their workshop technicians and skilled service engineers in terms of accreditation. Most importantly, looking at unemployed youth, which we have a program specifically looking at science graduateships and learnerships, creating experiential opportunities that eventually lead to them becoming productive parts of the workforce within South Africa. We also have a program looking at disabled learners, but also creating opportunities both for careers and for learning. And this we see is really, and I think it leads to why for us, NHI is such a critical factor, is if you want to be playing in the South African space, you need to be an active member, not just from a revenue point of view, but actually active contributor in terms of societal space. I've mentioned before that through acquisition, we've grown our portfolio. And typically as a company, we play across a fairly broad space, but really impact the patient journey across multiple touch points. Typically in the diagnostic space, there's a lab environment in terms of microbiology and oncology diagnosis, but also in terms of sample acquisition, where BD was the company in that patented the vacuum tube, which now is commonly used in terms of blood draws across healthcare. In more other areas, in terms of syringe, all the way from syringes right on into the automation in terms of contribution in theater care for hernia repair as well as vascular cardiology solutions. So we operate in a space where really, I would say, the more simple solutions in the healthcare space, but right to the end of the way to the more complex, data-driven robotic solutions, which gives us really good insights in terms of the healthcare space, the patient journey, but most importantly, allows us to have critical touch points in improving patient outcomes. When looking at specifically at patient outcomes, as a company, we look to kind of play in spaces which are relevant, contribute to societal issues, HIV, AIDS, TB, diabetes, women's health and cancer. One of the big areas of really critical from a healthcare spend point of view, antimicrobial resistance, key
healthcare worker and patient safety. But what we do recognize as a company, while we need to be driving access to patient solutions, we need to be cognizant of cost. We need to be cognizant of in terms of how do we improve efficiencies within the clinical space. But really, if you're doing all of that right, lowering the cost of healthcare, we've recognized that one of the key strengths that we do have as a company, that we do not operate in the spaces that we do alone. And we've really built a solid contribution in healthcare by delivering and really building on solid healthcare partnerships across the globe. And these really in the donor fund spaces, in kind of funding agencies within the healthcare space, but also partners that deliver clinical care packages, WHO, American Red Cross, UNICEF. We've not just done that on the global scale. Within the African context, these are exactly the AU and CDC, Africa CDC. These are the organizations we work with because we recognize by working with organizations which work within the African context, we can look to deliver better value, different patient care, but most importantly, understand the needs of where healthcare is going and adapt appropriately so we can make a more relevant contribution to where we are wanting to be. With regards to more specific in terms of why we are here this afternoon in terms of NHI, firstly, if you look at where BD sits from a NHI and their perspective on that, I think nobody living in South Africa cannot recognize the inequalities in the healthcare system. So I think it's really admirable from the South African government wanting to see how they both address the inequity in healthcare, but also deliver greater quality of healthcare to all. And that from a universal healthcare point of view is definitely something that BD as an organization supports. And we do that across the globe in our role in healthcare institutions and delivering better patient care. Most importantly, we are very much aligned with the Sustainable Development Goals 3.8, which is built around universal healthcare coverage, looking at financial risk protection in the healthcare space, and access to quality essential healthcare services. As an organization, we're geared to do that not just by the products we deliver, but in essence, as you will hear more of this afternoon, the medtech space and IVD space is not purely about the product. It's a comprehensive service delivery which involves training, care, and an ecosystem to ensure that patients not have the right products on time, but also that clinicians are appropriately trained to utilize those products and deliver the care within theater, within labs, and so forth. Within the next series of slides, we'll provide commentary around a couple of key areas. And one of the areas which I've spoken about is our ability where we have partners across the globe, but in Africa, is really about the role of private healthcare in support of delivering quality healthcare. We'll definitely focus on key areas in terms of the medtech sector and the role that it plays within the healthcare system, the procurement of medical technology, health HTA and assessment, and also the accreditation process. Because we have this interlink between how to provide care appropriately with the right product at the right time to the right patient. And we'll end off in terms of our views on the benefit package, but also some concerns which we'll see in terms from a legal point of view. And I'll then look to summarize at the end. For the balance of the presentation, I'll be supported by Adila as well as Avanti. And for the next slide, I'll hand over to Adila.
So good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. So if we look at the role of the private healthcare sector, BD believes that the private healthcare sector could play a very important role in terms of delivering national health insurance through a more rapid, innovative and constructive approach in terms of achieving these objectives. By leveraging existing current best practices amongst private healthcare stakeholders such as BD, as well as utilizing the resources, capabilities and systems which we already do have in place. So just to give you some examples where BD has contributed to the healthcare system in South Africa, and we believe that through these examples we can expand to an even greater contribution under NHI. With the onset of COVID, BD provided R&D support not only in developing rapid point-of-care antigen testing to support the testing of the South African population, but also very quickly was able to deliver customized devices for vaccine delivery And in terms of customized devices, I'm talking about the syringes required to, for example, inject the Pfizer vaccine, which was a very specific requirement, which BD was then able to manufacture and to bring to the market around the globe, but also in South Africa. We've been collaborating for the past few years with the University of Cape Town, as well as with Groote Schuur Hospital, in terms of advancing safety in healthcare. As Ian mentioned, healthcare safety and patient safety is one of the key priorities of BD. And through our expertise in this field, we have developed, in partnership with Groote Schuur Hospital, a safety simulation center where healthcare workers are able to practice safety skills, such as safe injection practices, before they actually go out into the real world and have to do it on patients. We're also involved in training on brachytherapy technology for prostate cancer in the state in the public sector. And then we have multiple surgical skills cadaver training on surgical skills such as hernia repair. BD has a very extensive Labs for Life program, which involves strengthening and capacitating healthcare and labs in Africa. Because as you know, without diagnosis, we're not able to treat diseases, and therefore labs play a very important role in the healthcare system and will also play this role under NHI. We are also involved in terms of digital diabetes patient education programs with various pharmacies in South Africa. These are just a few examples in terms of some of the therapeutic areas where BD can bring our expertise and be collaborative partners under an NHI system. Next slide, please, Ian. So earlier we heard our pharmaceutical colleagues speak about the pharmaceutical sector and the importance of medicines and drugs to healthcare. But what I would like to focus on today is that there's a clear distinction between the medtech industry and the pharmaceutical industry. And I think most of us are very familiar with medicines and with drugs and with the pharmaceutical industry, but not so much with the medtech industry. So I'd just like to touch on some of the differences which we believe will down the line impact how we approach medical technology under NHI, especially when it comes to procurement, as well as valuing medical technology under an NHI system. So as starters, the active components that go into medical technology, diagnostics and devices are based on mechanical, electrical and materials engineering, as opposed to pharmacology and chemistry, which feed into medicines and drugs. In terms of product development, we have a wide variety of products and applications, from thermometers and tongue depressors, which are quite simple and easy to manufacture and use, to large-scale devices such as X-ray machines and automated diagnostic machinery. These medical devices are designed to perform specific functions and most act through physical interaction with the body or with a body part, unlike pharmaceutical products, which is administered either by mouth or skin or eyes or inhalation. So the application of medical devices to patients can sometimes be far more complex. In terms of innovation, we find that in the medtech industry, there's continuous innovation and iterative improvements on the technologies that exist as new science and new technology come to the fore, and that the product life cycle as a result is very short, approximately 18 months, as compared to the pharmaceutical industry where you often have a patent protection of a few years on a drug molecule. The majority of new products bring added functions and incremental improvements. So we wouldn't, for example, bring a completely new diagnostic machine to the market, but one that perhaps improved on an older version. So we constantly need to keep up with new versions of existing technology in order to make sure that we stay ahead of innovation. And then finally, Ian alluded to this, but the investment required into medical technology is quite large compared to the pharmaceutical industry, not just in terms of manufacturing and distribution, but also the training and education that goes into the proper use of medical devices and diagnostics. And there's often aftercare support, both to the patient as well as the institution to which we provide our devices and diagnostics, as well as ongoing servicing that will be required of these medical devices and technologies. And all of these, the reason why we highlight it is because, next slide please, Ian, when it comes to NHI, we believe that there needs to be a recognition and distinction of the medical technology industry as opposed to the pharmaceutical industry, because as you would well be aware, medical devices play a vital role across the continuum of healthcare, whether it be prevention, screening such as cervical cancer screening, diagnosis of cancers, treatment such as prostate cancer, as I've mentioned, with brachytherapy, and then rehabilitation as well as palliative care. In terms of expenditure, the budget consumed by MedTech is far smaller than the pharma value budget, but MedTech plays a significant role in terms of delivering efficient healthcare to the South African population and has very distinct characteristics in impact procurement, as well as practices in terms of how we value medical technology and devices when it comes to making decisions around cost-effective treatment. For this reason, we make the following recommendations to the NHI Bill. We recommend that there be a distinct difference between medicines and medical devices and diagnostics in terms of how it is dealt with under the NHI Bill. And to aid this, we recommend that the terms medical device and IVD, as defined already in the Medicines Act, should be incorporated into the NHI Bill. Currently, it's bundled under health goods, but we believe that it deserves its category just because of the uniqueness of this industry and the distinct characteristics of this industry. We also believe that because it is so technical in nature, that there should be expertise in medical devices and diagnostics that needs to be included in the decision-making bodies, such as the Benefits Advisory Committee, the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee, and the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. These committees do mention that there should be expertise when it comes to medicines and drugs and to healthcare, but we believe that there's a certain set of skill required in terms of medical devices and diagnostics that needs to be inclusive in these decision-making bodies. The NHI Bill does mention an essential equipment list, but we would just recommend that it be developed to be broad and to include all the essential equipment and diagnostics that are currently recognized as being standard of care internationally, and that are also recognized on the WHO essential devices list. Next slide, please, Ian. Okay, at this point, I hand over to my colleague Avanti to speak more about the procurement, the HDA process, and accreditation.
Yes, Adilan, I just need to check that I am, you're able to hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thanks. So I'm going to focus on those areas in MedTech, I think, where we probably have quite a variety of expertise in the business that we're currently in, and that is on the procurement, the HDA process, and accreditation. Next slide, please. Okay, essentially, as Adela and Ian have spoken about, the variations in MedTech need to be considered when we look at the procurement system. I draw attention to the bullet points specifically that we do have variances in software, medical equipment comes with consumables, servicing, maintenance, and training, and capital equipment and consumables are not always interchangeable, in that you may need platforms that require specific products and not a variety that can be used on those platforms. We talked about the cycle of innovation. We also talked about a centralized versus a decentralized procurement system. Currently, the NHI Bill recommends a centralized procurement system. However, we feel it may result in some practical implications for medical technology specifically. We look at the areas of unmet patient needs and clinical variation amongst patients, a lack of innovation, or perhaps a less fast pace of innovation within the NHI. And exclusive contracts within a centralized mechanism, obviously not best, because it prevents multiple models and types required to meet specific needs. Together with MedTech in the procurement system, we have to consider that equipment needs to be maintained. There is a level of servicing and technical support and education and training that must be considered. We recommend a value-based approach that looks at the life cycle cost of healthcare delivery and provides wider outcomes of care for the patient and society. Next slide, please, Oliver. Okay, some of our recommendations look at the procurement system, recognizing the complexity, and I think we've mentioned this a few slides ago. There is an international best practice of procurement called NEAT, and that is most economically advantageous tender approach. A decentralized procurement system where applicable, as compared to a centralized system. And this we talk specifically to MedTech because it considers specific patient needs in the life cycle, including the servicing and maintenance requirements, which may not be easy to centralize in terms of providing this after-sale service. We do need some agility in the procurement process, specifically because of the MedTech improvement cycles that we talked about. We look for a tailored approach, especially for specialized or custom-made devices, an establishment of the substantial essential equipment and diagnostic list to support the standardization process. The value-based procurement that is used in the EU, as I said, is called MEAT, Most Economically Advantageous Tender Approach. And the benefits of this approach does lead to improved outcomes for patients. It looks at cost of care efficiency and also looks at benefits for other stakeholders. Next slide, please, Adina. We talked quite a bit about health technology assessment in the previous presentation, so I won't go too much into it. We're not suggesting that there are no internal capabilities for HTA within the NHI. However, global practice does favor the independence of an HTA agency. So where there may be skills within NHI to analyze and review the HTA recommendations, the independence of the NHI is proven globally to be something that is required for a system to make objective and effective decisions. The HTA process should not become an administrative bottleneck that limits patient access. We have a very recent example where the NHLS had established an HTA system and further had to discontinue this due to several delays in getting access to laboratory equipment and care. We recommend the development of an independent agency to conduct an expert, efficient, and uniform HTA process in South Africa if patient-focused and seeks to achieve best value. Next slide, please. The accreditation steps on this slide refer to product accreditation and supplier accreditation. I'll focus on this product accreditation to start. The recommendation here is that SAHPRA remains the only regulator for medical devices and in vitro diagnostics. We also recommend that the independence of SAHPRA be maintained and an adoption and inclusion of a quality management system with a clear set of operating procedures be incorporated using our recognized standards of SABS and ISO accreditation. We recognize there is a clear strengthening required in the assessment of skills for medical devices. Therefore, the registration, certification, and accreditation must be supported by efficient processes. Delays in contracting of sufficient and appropriate providers and suppliers could impact negatively on patient access to appropriate and necessary care. Thank you.
My apologies. I was tech challenged for a moment between multiple screens. I think for the next couple of slides, I think which I'll just like to kind of bring it all together and summarize areas of as discussed before. And I think what's been shared in the slides today is that there's a complexity around the MedTech and IVD space, and special recognition needs to be happening for that. But globally, when BD looks at looking at NHI, we're very supportive that all levels of care be considered. That includes be totally inclusive, both primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary care. I think there's some areas within the bill currently where additional details or clarity, and I think during some of the discussions this morning, some of that clarity has come through, but I think constant communication around that will be critical. The fund via the benefits advisor can determine the healthcare services benefits due to users. Some areas of outstanding details would be, I think, in the ongoing discussions with the kind of parliamentary committee around the financing models, the level of details into the current benefits package and the description and details of procurement process. A great expansion in that areas will be really great to hear from as we get progress and information around the bill itself. Only complementary benefits can be purchased from medical schemes. Greater clarification around what that means. And I think we've heard about the transition phase and then the kind of post-transition phase. So really clarity in terms of the details around that would be good to hear going forward. The Medical Schemes Act allows the Minister of Health Register to prohibit schemes from providing NHI benefits. And I think, again, we speak about transitions and the final act and what that would look like would be really from both a patient, provider, as well as the healthcare system point of view, which you hear more. So in terms of recommendations, is really the freedoms of choice in access to healthcare covered by under the NHI should be considered and linked to phased implementation. Largely because of the complexity implementing a scale of change in healthcare, the size of what a NHI is looking to implement. And so to ensure success, the milestones around that have been very clearly defined. Because of the, especially related to the MedTech space, benefits design and spaces should be reviewed at least annually to be updated in terms of changing external dynamics. BD supports the bill statement that the emergence of new technologies, must be considered in treatment guidelines. And especially, as I would say, within the MedTech space, changes to technology are much more rapid than within the pharmaceutical space. And I think linked to that, underpinned by some of the comments in the earlier discussions, that decisions would continue to base on sound medical evidence. The cost to drive cost effective, this should not necessarily mean cheapest, but about driving the best outcome. And the governance process and selection, function of the benefits advisory committee and health services pricing committee should be more adequately defined. And I think we've recognized purely because of the complexity of MedTech devices, prerequisite, I would say, would be that adequate representation of the expertise on these committees will be really critical to ensure and support the decision-making processes going forward. Some legal concerns, and I think globally, and I recognize that the way the bill is formed for the NHI is different to other areas, but I think critically governance decision-making, which currently centralized in the Minister of Health, to see how that can be strengthened. Centralizing decision-making poses risk and is often not in good accordance with the good governance principles. We look to, obviously, the Minister of Health establishing the appropriate committees around benefits, pricing, as well as the advice committees and technical committees. Importantly, it's really critical that the independence of the boards of these committees and technical areas really be critical. Again, in terms of legal concerns, but I would say some of that has already been addressed in some of the comments you heard in an earlier section, that the Constitution forms the foundation around the framework in terms of implementation of NHI, and we're definitely supportive of that. Key, again, as I mentioned, separation of legislative and executive powers really needs to be maintained. Inclusion in decision-making, one in terms of the range of competencies around NHI and specialist areas to be seen, with especially in terms of the prerequisite representation of MedTech on the relevant stakeholder advisory committees to be present. So if I take a step back in terms of what you've heard about BD and what you shared with regards to NHI. Firstly, as an organization, very much committed to attainment of universal healthcare coverage
And this we do in presence in terms of the contributions we make, not just in where we're present in South Africa, but in other countries where VDA has a presence. Because I think equitable access to quality healthcare is the right for every citizen, and I think that forms the kind of cornerstone of NHI, and definitely as a company, we're very much supportive of that in terms of that goal achieved. But we do recognize, based on the complexity, size, and scale of NHI implementation, a phased approach with clear milestones being set, as opposed to be purely time-based, to say, let's make sure that we have the right infrastructure, the right IT systems, the right shift when we switch off the, if we look to switch off the private sector to a purely one sector system, that those transitions happen appropriately, timelessly, and really set the NHI up for success as we shift to a different model in providing healthcare going forward. Access to all South Africans having best standard of care definitely supported from a corporate point of view. But we do see that there needs to be, and I think some more greater description in the how the role of the private health sector can support support in providing choice, but also creating a competitive landscape to allow innovation and growth. As shared by Avanti, the procurement system really to be allowing with the National Department's Health Strategic Plan to recognize the difference in that procurement processes in how IVDs, MedTech differ from pharma and other parts of the technology that's required for successful rollout of NHI. I think critical to the success of this will be strong government structure, representative of all sectors to having a voice at the table. And I think what is really being critical, and I think an example of what we have today in terms of this parliamentary committee, the fact that we are able to have discussions, so that I think that continuous transparency around information sharing and constructive engagement really critical. Ongoing, obviously, we do see a greater detail in terms of financing about NHI to be shared to really frame what will be critical to providing equitable healthcare and quality healthcare to all South Africans. I mean, I think as BD, we want to be part of that journey, and we have recognized the differences and what MedTech is and the role that it can play. Most importantly, I think to really frame an environment where the outcomes of patients are improved, the disparity which you currently have in the healthcare system is definitely not sustainable. And those goals around NHI definitely look to be achieved, but in the framework of good governance, in the framework of quality care and evidence-based, really critical, together with transparency. So again, thank you for the opportunity to present today. And look forward to taking questions, from yourselves with regard to the views BD has raised. In the last, within the presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, Ian and the team. The following members in this order have requested to interact with your presentation, and I'll allow them to come through. The first one will be Honorable Munyai, second one, Honorable Ismail, third will be Honorable Chirwa, who, if she has a challenge with her connectivity, will then write her question down, but she's number three. Fourth is Honorable Gela. Number five, Honorable Dr. Harvard. Six, Honorable Dr. Jacobs. And seven, Honorable Dr. Thembe Kwayo. In that order. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. My first question to BD will be as follows. On the slide number 10, there seems to be an inherent assumption that only the private sector can achieve rapid, innovative, and constructive progress to implement NHI. I want to put it to you clearly, though, that the public sector is meant to be the backbone of the NHI, and is also capable of coming up with innovative technologies or innovative means. The bill also provides for cross-sectoral collaboration where necessary. Is it the assumption of the BD
that without making the private sector a core component of the NHI, when it should not be, then it should not be implemented. That's the understanding that I need clarity. The other question, if Ian could remember, section slide number 12 on your presentation, why is it deemed necessary by BD that they should not be represented on all, they should be represented on all key structures of the NHI? Is it not self-benefit suggestion that is merely meant to ensure that the expertise in this area can be used to influence decision? And if the structure included all stakeholders, would that not be making the structures too big and also unmanageable, that is adversely and adversely impacting on decision making and implementing action plans? What forms of assessment does BD believe should be in place to ensure that we only distribute and introduce effective and good quality medical devices into our South African healthcare system? There are sections, section 57, subsection 3D, and section 38, subsection 2 in the bill, not give comfort to the medtech will be treated differently. BD should look at the bill carefully to understand the certification and accreditation is very different and who's responsible thereof. My understanding is that this does not fall under SAPRA responsibilities, and I'm sure they should look into that. The other issues that where they raise the concern about the ministers. In the country of origin of BD, New Jersey in the US, the country governance system is different. It is federalism, which means that there could be sense of decentralization in various states, whilst in South Africa, we have a democratic unitary state, where central government, for instance, can play a significant role, such as the powers of the minister, as outlined in the executive. I'll give you an example. In a democratic system such as ours, a country that win election implement its own election mandate, manifesto mandate. Let me give you an example. The DA in Western Cape has won election. Instead of calling the position of the MEC, they call it ministers, meaning therefore those that win election, they decide how they want to govern. Does BD have the problem with the current democratic structure where the powers of the ministers are outlined as in the executive? And I'm saying this is a democratic outcome and a democratic structure. What BD believe is a threat of the democratically elected minister with executive powers enshrined in the constitution? Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the presentation. I just have three questions. One, how do you view the effects of NHI on medical innovation and technology? My second question, do you believe it would improve or rather decrease the possibility to innovation growth in the healthcare sector? And my third question, just for clarity on the basis of, you know, the minister being, you know, the person responsible for, you know, allocating the team, if I could put it, would you then rather suggest that Parliament elects the committee overseeing the NHI and the bill, most especially when it comes to expenditure? I'm asking your view on the corruption and how NHI will be, you know, maybe used as a tool for corruption. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Please feel free to stop me if I'm unable to be heard. Firstly, thank you for the presentation, BD. I think you are presenting very strong arguments that don't require us to overlook them, especially if we move them on a case basis, if I may. For example, the methods or medical intervention methods
in the public sector and the private sector are not always the same. And thus, it creates a problem on how we decipher medical evidence of the response of the private sector to that of the public sector. And that will subsequently then influence the procurement process of medical goods and medical equipment and medical medical issues, right? I don't know if this is a question more than it is a comment, but then I want to ask, Uthi, what exactly, how, which case specifics can we point to support this argument? For example, there's the issue of surgical mesh that is still very widely used in South Africa, regardless of the issues that it has. There's a case of a woman that we were trying to deal with the Minister of Health, but to no success. Where South Africa, even after the FDA had prompted the issues with surgical mesh for certain procedures, South Africa still uses surgical mesh. And that is not primarily the case in the private care, in the private facilities. So I want to know, how then do we reach a middle ground? Is it possible to reach a middle ground? And then how do we then assess evidence, as opposed to the response from the public sector and the private sector, if they are not fundamentally the same? And I hear also the argument on the selection of the committee, something that has been raised before. And I think the Honorable Hasina before me just raised it as well, if maybe the portfolio committee should be involved in the selection of the committee, as is, for example, in NSFAS, as is, for example, with NYDA. So the issue of absolute power, if I may, in inverted commas, is also something that we had seen as an issue in reading the bill. So I want to know, what then is the proposal of BD in regards to this particular issue? Because not something that we can just easily just weigh off and ignore, noting the history of South Africa and the issue of the abuse of power and nepotism and all issues that we have seen unraveling for the past 27 years, 28 years, in fact. So I want to know, what then is the proposal of BD in relation to that subsection that outlines that the minister is in control of choosing the committee? So those are my two comments. Bridging the gap between the private and public sector in regards to medical interventions, and also in contrast to that, evidence that points to the fact that even the response of the public care sector and the private care sector is not primarily the same, and how this will also affect procurement of services, of goods, of facilities, of equipment in the process of the NHI. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
You were very clear. Your voice came out clearly. But if other members, if they have no challenge to switch on their videos, they can do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation from BD. I've got only one question that I want to ask, Chairperson. You have made recommendations for the establishment of the Independent Health Technology Assessment Organization. Are you not satisfied with the stipulations in Section 57 of the bill, which outlines that the Ministerial Advisory Committee on Health Technology Assessment for the National Health Insurance must be established to advise the Minister on Health Technology Assessment? My understanding is that this committee will be a prescriptor to the Health Technology Assessment Agency. Does this not address your recommendations? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, BD presenter. Your concerns about limiting choice and clarity on complementary benefits are noted. But let me ask you whether you think that Section 25 of the bill, which talks about the functions of the Benefits Advisory Committee, is not adequate. You may want to address Section 25 with Section 6, 8, and 33. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. And thank you to the presenters for the presentation. They highlight certain legal concerns in one of their slides, where they state that any limitation to existing rights must meet the requirements of Section 36 of the Constitution. Now, we are also aware that the Constitutional Court has extensive jurisprudence in the limitation of rights in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution. Therefore, do they still think it is necessary for this to be included in legislation? And the cases, there are similar cases which speak to the same challenge, and I raised it before with another group, that they should actually go and look at those cases and maybe familiarize themselves with that to get a reasonable understanding. And also to understand what is justifiable in an open and democratic society. So they could hopefully just raise and answer that point for me. And then given BD's experience internationally and in Africa in particular, what lessons can we incorporate into this African setting to ensure delivery of cost-effective healthcare? And then lastly, it is usually unclear how medical devices are priced in South Africa. Just looking at what has been mentioning in terms of the specific patient needs which were raised, and then a decentralized procurement system, etc. The question is, what do they propose? Should we look at introducing to ensure that we have transparency in the sector? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes.
I've got only one question. Yeah, and it's based on a number of approaches that were mentioned during the presentation. For an example, the tailored approach, substantive, essential, and value-based approaches. But I would like to request, if it's possible, that can they give us just a number of locally and internationally research-based authoritative references to support their approach or argument for consideration of inclusion in NHI amendment sections, should there be an opportunity that can exist. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Timbekwaya. BD, you have made a statement that you'd like to see greater inclusivity. Various institutions that have come in here to make presentations have also been like saying, don't forget us. And they've been specifically mentioning their names, like say, we would want to be considered on this and that committee as psychologists or as pharmacists, as the, this professional body. So in your statement, you say, concluding remarks, please make sure that it is a, it has a greater inclusivity approach. Who are you referring to? Are you just broadly making a general statement, or there's a specific professional body or expertise that you think is going to be left out or could be left out if not mentioned, if you can provide us with that? Number two, what are you saying with regards to the private sector, maybe stock medical schemes? Are you saying you would want to see that so that there's a choice of a service and possibly of a payment by medical scheme right through, or maybe at a particular transitional stage of the NHI? It would be important to hear what are you saying to that, to say, no, you would like to see the existence of these medical aid schemes, not probably complementary, not during the transitional period, but right through the whole process of NHI. If you could just assist us with your comments in that regard. We can then give you back to you to comment if there's no other member wanting to ask. Yes.
Firstly, honourable members, thank you for the extremely broad range of
of questions that you've risen. And I think what I will do is really, I'm trying to group them around certain areas and ask them. Avanti will be dealing with the questions around sort of HDA and the technology space. I'll deal with the kind of themes around inclusivity, as well as the role of private sector and the perceived expectation that BDS share that we want to be part of different committees. So maybe what I will do is start off by saying, I think those questions came from the first Dr. Munwai. That question came up, and then I think secondly we also had the questions from Dr. Jacobs versus centralized versus decentralized. So maybe in commentary, I think the comment was made in slides 10 that BDs perceive that only the private sector can introduce innovation. I think firstly that was definitely not the point. I think firstly the public healthcare sector in South Africa has a history of innovation. The point rather being the point being made is really that the private sector can contribute and can partner to both provide resources, expertise to accelerate innovation. And I think BD as a company is presenting itself as open to do that. And we have a history not just in South Africa, but in other countries and other kind of healthcare settings of doing that. And that's a legacy we're really proud of doing. With regards to the question about BD wanting to be represented, there was also the relation of the question about the size and scope of committee. In terms of being, and it also deals with the area around inclusivity. And I think I'm not necessarily in any of those comments to say that BD needs to be part of a committee. And I think what is really critical, we spoke about stakeholders, advisory committees, different committees. The essence is that the expertise relevant to the subject area, that those expertise be leaned on. And we have within the medical device and technology space, we have SAMED, we have SALDA, which are organizations within that space. So it doesn't necessarily have to be corporate, but definitely I think again within the universities that we have specific expertise. So, and the recognition there is that while NHI is driving clear goals, there's certain areas of specialities around procurement, certain specialities around technology that wherever possible, that be included as appropriate. In going forward to limit both size of committees or complexity in terms of those committees going forward. But I think definitely the expertise needs to be the right expertise on the right committees being there to support that. There's been a couple of questions where reflected about, which we said, I would say, the role of Parliament and decision-making, the role of the Ministry of Health. And I think firstly, the commentary is that whatever the final approach is in NHI in terms of making sure that we do have good first government. I mean, Parliament already has oversight in terms of the statutory bodies. And this is not necessarily saying BD where it's coming from the US, which is a federal state system, and South Africa is a democratically elected state system, but really to make sure that there is correct oversight to ensure government. Whether that final decision making, and that is a role like the parliamentary committee, which we currently have, takes that role of oversight. But I think that should be part of the finalization with regards to that process. There was more than one question, I think, from Honorable Jacobs around centralized versus decentralized procurement. And some of the context around that is really about, I think within centralized procurement, if you're procuring something like a tongue depressors or syringes, I think the standards around those are fairly common. The standards in terms of adjudication of process is fairly simple. So fairly, in terms of looking at centralized procurement on bulk, on large teams, is fairly much easy to do. But again, as come from the comment made by Honorable Chirwa, for example, when speaking about hernia meshes, much more specialized, much more used within specific specialities, so not broadly used for specific surgeons. And I think the specificities around certain technologies needs a much more localized approach that needs to be evidence-based. The commentary with regards to private sector currently making different choices versus public sector. I think from a BD comment to point of view is we should have a common approach in terms of how to utilize evidence to ensure best patient outcome, and therefore the recommendation in terms of, from a Vanted mentioned, in terms of these methodologies in EU called MEET, where they're looking at best procurement, right product in terms of evidence-based. And I think the challenge is always in medicine to have the right bodies making those decisions around evidence-based. It should definitely not be coming from corporate because we have a commercial goal and interest in that, but definitely in terms of making sure that within the necessary committees that are framing the kind of benefit structure, framing the what would be on the EEL list going forward, the necessary expertise exists to support that decision-making. Because, again, I think a point to have a common mechanism to best decide what is the best approach for a broad group of patients, while we need to have potentially speciality decision around certain patient types of cases or certain disease management areas because of the where they fall within the treatment paradigm. The other questions which we have, the question from Honorable Harvard around complementary choice in terms of the role of the medical aids and funders. I think for the reason for really raising those choices and role of funders going forward right now, because the defined benefit package for NHI has not been totally completed, and that's a work in progress. And therefore, when you say what is complementary services, and I think that will be an evolving space going forward, because what may be deemed to be complementary service at year X may be included in as part of the comprehensive package of care in NHI 5 years down the line. So that will be an evolving space going forward. And I think the constant review of what falls within the different spaces is really critical to make sure we deliver equitable quality care to patients on a broad basis. But that is going to be a moving space as clinical evidence changes, new technology comes to the fore, innovation speeds up treatment of patients, reduces cost of treatment of patients. For me, that's why there's no defined answer, but I think what does need to be clarified and where information will be constantly needed within that space is the shape and form of those two very different segments going forward. I would then see if I have covered the sections which I thought I would. And I'd maybe get Avanti to speak around really the areas we spoke about HDA and assessment and the differences that I would say medical devices and IVD bring to patient care.
Thanks, Ian. So I think I'll start off with Honorable Shilidzi's question on the role of software and assessments, and of course the difference between accreditation and registration of products. This comment comes largely from the recent experience we had on PPE just over a year ago. We were quite involved in that process of the procurement of PPE. The comment comes as a standard, I think, that needs to be established that only SAHPRA-registered products as well as SAHPRA-licensed suppliers be considered in the procurement system. And this is something that is already regulated, but what we saw last year didn't actually happen as such and brought about several, I would say, questionable quality products on the market, but as well as suppliers who may not have been involved in that particular business before. And not to go into too much detail, our standpoint is that SAHPRA is the sort of gatekeeper and the regulator for regulating medical devices and IVDs. We'd like it to remain that way. SAHPRA is also responsible for crediting or licensing companies that provide medical devices and IVDs as they're able to assess the quality management system, the performance and effectiveness of devices and IVDs, and we'd like that to remain the same. And as SAHPRA is an independent entity apart from the process of that continue. I think the second question around HTA, and I think Honorable Geller asked the question, does Section 57 cover this adequately in terms of independence? I don't believe so. It does recommend the Ministerial Advisory Committee as a precursor to an agency, but I think the concern here is that that agency should be independent, and even though it's not said so in the bill, and maybe we're assuming that it will be, that it's something we must consider for the agency moving forward, that it is independent of the process. Honourable Harvard talked about lessons that we've learned in lessons that we've learned across the continent, as BD does business in many countries in Africa. I think one area we mustn't forget is localization. And I don't think perhaps we've addressed that enough throughout this process and our response to the pandemic. But as we work with partners, especially such as the DTI, et cetera, we've tried to bring about the localization of technologies in that we can manufacture technologies in Africa for Africa. And we have tried on several fronts, I believe, to ensure that there is some take-off, but there are many barriers that still exist for localization. And we look forward to working with government on removing those barriers, because as long as we are importing more than 98% of our medical technologies into South Africa, we will always be reliant and dependent on external sources. So I think as a company, we are very, very committed to assisting localization processes. As an industry, we want to see that happen. Localization, of course, then affects transformation, and I think it can only be a good thing if we're able to ensure that this happens. How can BD help in that sector? I think we look at tech transfers or ensuring that technologies that can be produced in South Africa are supported. So I think our biggest lesson, just to answer shortly, Honorable Harvard, is that in countries in Africa where they've managed to produce locally, and those are very few, the dependence on importation of devices, of course, decreases. And it does produce some level of stability in particular areas. Thank you. Ian, I think that's all I had to answer.
Just apologies. I think the questions around learning from Africa came from Honourable Jacobs.
Thank you.
I don't know, Honourable Chair, if there are additional questions or areas of clarity. I know there were quite a few questions, and my apologies to anybody if I have missed a specific question, please feel free to raise them again.
Is there any member who feels that his or her question has not been answered, or maybe wants to make a follow-up, I'll make an allowance for that now. Maybe BD can hold on if I have that slot so that we can take that, which was outstanding, together with any other additional comments or questions members would like to raise. Okay. There's no follow-up from any member. Maybe you can then add on whatever you had yourself was left out.
The question is, how do you view the effects of NHI on innovation? Look, I think innovation is something that is an absolute requirement within the healthcare space, because it leads to increased patient care. I think one of the opportunities in terms of limited and competitive nations is, for example, if you have tenders where you have winners take all, what you do is limit the number of vendors or suppliers within the space, and that potentially can limit innovation. For me, there's two things. There's limiting innovation, which happens within the country, and there's limiting innovation that happens of access of new products going forward. What is for me critical is access to innovative products to introduce patient care, reduce days in hospitals, and reduce cost of the healthcare system. That needs to be going on unhindered. And therefore, the reference to, if we're looking at an assessment of all medical devices in company, we use systems around HDA, we use MEAT, we're looking at value-based, what does the innovation bring to the country? So I think NHI, while as long as we have those safeguards in place or systems in place or methodology to assess, is there value to the innovation? NHI per se would not limit access to innovation, but it needs to be counterbalanced in terms of how we are assessing new technology, how do we look at innovation,
And making sure we have the capabilities to do so within the necessary advisory committees going forward, and therefore to make sure that we have the approach to who sits on those committees needs to be inclusive, both inclusive and diverse. Hopefully that answers your question, the last outstanding question.
Okay, no, thank you very much to all of you from BD for meeting with you and getting your presentations. The members were actually very interactive with your presentations. We're looking forward to interacting with you, but also continue meeting with the department, raising these issues because they are quite important. Thank you very much. We'd like to then release you from this platform. Honorable members, if one is to make announcements, thank you very much for being here up to now. This is our last presentation for the day. We will meet again tomorrow at 10:10 to take presentations. It's a bit of a longer day than today, but thank you very much for always being there, participating, and also involving the presenters with those very important questions. We then put this meeting to close. The meeting is adjourned till tomorrow. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, may I just ask you a question, please?
Yes.
Is Safra coming tomorrow to our portfolio committee?
No.
Okay, thank you.
As a short notice for them, we only wrote them a letter. They received it yesterday. So short notice to come today, tomorrow. So we were going to get them today because we have a shorter day today. So they got the letter on Monday, but they were not ready for today. Tomorrow we do have a longer day, so we did not want to include them into tomorrow's program then.
Maybe. Thank you, Honorable Chair. It's been a really great opportunity to have a fairly very constructive discussions with the honorable members of the committee today. Really, thanks for being part of the process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to all your members who came in. Thank you.